Okay, you ready? You expecting words, Rob?
He's going to come back in a few minutes.
Okay. Okay, so last night I promised, or I warned, actually, before I promised, I warned you that you're going to have to, in order to understand the, in order for us to deal with the economic crisis that we're actually facing, that we have to, that people have to understand the American system, which most people don't. We talked a lot about that last night, and we can talk more about it. But we also have to understand something even more, which is the scientific principles on which the American system is based. And that's what I want to talk about today, which is not what people normally think about economics. People normally think about economics, they think about usually something which has nothing to do with economics. They think about money. Money has nothing to do with economics. So eliminate money as anything having to do with reality. But also, if you eliminate money, people also think about economics. They start to then babble about physical production and the means of existence of life and these kinds of things. But that's not what economics is really about. The basic principles of what economics the modern concept of the science of economics is really founded by Leibniz. And I'll talk a lot about what Leibniz's understanding of economics. But actually, the first thing you have to understand when you're dealing with economics is that the most important thing about economics is that it has to do with people, with human beings. No, there's no such thing as a cow economy. Cows don't have economics. There's not the economics of dogs or cockroaches or any other species. Economics is specifically unique to human beings. And therefore, all economics depends on understanding something about the fundamental nature of man. Now, the fundamental nature of man is not something that you can decide, that's a matter of, I have this view of what the fundamental nature of man is. This is my view, and that's somehow true. That is, man has a certain nature, a certain characteristic, regardless of whether or not people actually are willing to, or even able to, but in most cases not able, in most cases it's willing to, recognize what their fundamental characteristic is. The biggest problem we have in the world today, which is not the first time in history this has happened, is that people have adopted a view of themselves which is the view they prefer to have because it fits a certain outcome, it fits a certain preconceived idea they have about how they want the world to work. But that doesn't necessarily make it true. And you see, when you look at the history of civilization, you see that societies have collapsed, disappeared, because people have failed to be willing to recognize what it is about themselves that will determine their outcome. Now, later this afternoon, you're going to hear a presentation, which is going to be very important, about this relationship of the nature, the importance of this concept of the nature of man in the context of the Brunelleschi's dome. So you're going to get a very specific discussion about how this works in history. And I gave certain other indications about it yesterday when I talked about the situation in Athens and and also in the Renaissance and the American Revolution. But what I want to look at now is this question of what is it about the nature of man that on which you have to base economic science? And I'll underscore the term science there. When we're talking about economic science, we're talking about what's true. We're not talking about opinion. We're not talking about economic systems. This is another sophistry. People think there are different economic systems. There's socialism, there's capitalism, there's free enterprise system, there's this system or that system. And we can choose among a smorgasbord of economic systems which one we like. And you have different people, they like different flavors of economic systems, and they argue with each other as to what system is correct. But we're not interested in economic systems, because all economic systems are by their very nature lies, because no such thing exists as an economic system. What exists is man's relationship to nature. What exists is the development of man. And that's what economics is about. Now, what is the development of mankind? Well, LaRouche is fond of using this chart, which I've referenced a couple times already, but I'll do it again, which is when you look at the population, human population of this planet, going back 10,000 years, which is about the best you can do for accurate figures, to the present, you see that the human population grows relatively steady until you get to the European Renaissance, and then you get an exponential takeoff. So you have that. But you also have, just in the general trend, you have an experimental fact, a scientific fact, that the human population of the planet has gone from approximately a few million to 6 billion people on the planet. Now, no other species has done that. And if you look at the relationship of man, of human beings, in human societies, from the population 10,000 BC to the present, you see that man's relationship to nature has changed. So this is a characteristic which also is unique to human beings. You do not have cows doing anything different today than cows did 2 million years ago. They eat grass, and when there's no grass, the cow starves. Nobody has ever seen a cow figure out how to grow grass. Cows might wander looking for grass, but they do not change the environment around them, nor do they, and this is more importantly, change their relationship to the environment around them. But human beings do. And if you look at the history of mankind, you see that there's a continuous change in the relationship of man, not only to nature, but also to other human beings. Now, and that this relationship at any given moment, therefore, since this is always changing, the question is, when you're trying to understand economics, when you're trying to look at an economy, understand what economics is, what is it that you're looking at? If these relationships, which we could call, in their broadest terms, economic relationships, these economic relationships are always changing as over the course of human history, what are we measuring? Well, how do you judge? What is it that is fundamental about economics? Because if you define what's fundamental about economics, the particular economic relationships at any given moment, you'll inherently make a false definition, because those economic relationships are going to change. So what is it that doesn't change? What is it that's fundamental? What is it that physicists would call an invariant principle. And what doesn't change is not economic relationships, but what is invariant is that which makes these economic relationships possible. And for that we use a concept that comes from the Greeks. In Greek science is associated with the concept of powers, which the Plato uses the Greek word dunamis, which is where the word dynamics comes from. And in Latin sometimes this is associated with the concept of potential or possibility. And Gauss introduced the use of the term potential in the physical sense, in the sense of physics, associated with the idea of gravitation, electricity, magnetism, and so forth. So the issue we're looking at is potential. And you're looking at economic potential. So LaRouche's emphasized, for example, that what you're actually measuring then in the economy is what is the potential to have increases in what he calls the relative population density. And the reason why we measure it that way is because on any given area of land, there's a certain relative population density which is relative to the geological characteristics of that territory. Obviously, this area has a very high relative population density compared to, say, the arid region like in the Western Plains State. Relatively speaking, the geological characteristics of this area can support a greater density of population. So if you take the relative, if you're looking at, when you're looking at relative population density, you're looking at what is the population density relative to the existing level of technology as applied to that geological characteristic. But that's not what you're measuring. That's not what you're interested in. What you're interested in is this other characteristic, which I already mentioned, potential relative population density. So what's important in the economy is not, or another way to think about this, is what's important in the economy is not what is, but what can be. Another way to think of potential is that which could be. Not what is, but what is possible. And that's what economics really concerns itself with. It concerns itself with not producing for immediate things, although it does produce those immediate things, but it produces those immediate things for the purpose of producing an increased potential for what could be. So I mean, your ability to produce economic output at any given moment is a function of what your existing potential is. You can't produce more than is possible to produce. Right now, we cannot produce, just like we cannot produce matter-antimatter reactions. So what our productive capacity is a function of what our current potential is. But our output is geared not to producing what is, but to changing that potential. Yes, do you have a question?
Yeah. So part of it, what I was wondering is why does it have to be measured in a potential increase of our relative population? Why not, for instance, the potential to increase our life quality with a certain same amount of population, for instance?
Well, because you can't. Because what is the source of that potential? The source of that potential is the creative powers of the human mind. Now, the creative powers of the human mind exist, surprisingly enough, in human minds. They do not exist in the ether. They do not exist in the world spirit. They do not exist in the air. they do not exist in some twilight zone out there. The creative powers of the human mind exist only in human beings.
So increasing population, increase the creativity.
Increases the number of human beings. And without increasing the number of human beings, you can't increase the number of the amount of creative ideas.
Can we get enough creative ideas out of 6 billion people?
But think about how many more creative ideas we can get out of 35 billion people. So if you limit, if you say, well, there's a limit to the number of people we want, you're saying, well, then I decide that we should not have, we should be limited to human creativity.
And what would be wrong with that?
Well, then you...
If your purpose is not to increase population.
But why, but that's what I'm saying. If you're, that's why I'm talking about what economics is. Not economic systems. I'm talking about what economics is for human beings. You're increasing the potential for human beings to increase their potential of creative output. So if you eliminate human beings, or you don't allow human beings to exist, you're destroying the creative, you're not increasing the potential. This is why I'm saying that this is why I said in the very beginning that the first thing you got to settle on here is what is economics about? It's about human beings. And if you begin by saying, okay, it's about human beings, but only about some human beings, the 6 billion who are already alive, well, then you've already limited it. But it's not. It's about humanity in general. Because every single person who's alive today, surprisingly enough, is going to be dead. Mm-hmm. Every single human being who is alive today was not alive at one point. Their life began and their life ended. But humanity didn't begin when you were born, and it's not going to end when you die. So you have a relationship as an individual human being not only to your own life, but to all humanity, past, present, and future. And that's where, and no other creature, no other species has that relationship. A dog or a cow or another animal has a mortal life like a human being, but their mortal life does not perpetuate through their species after they die. And when a cow dies, the kingdom of cows does not recognize the difference. But human beings have a permanent contribution to humanity long beyond their mortal life. And that's no other speech. So this is what economics has to be organized around. The way people always fall into the mistake of the oligarchy is they think that you can have, and this is what passes for economics in every economics class, in every economics textbook, in every university, in every country on earth, which is you sit up there and they talk about economic systems and economic policies as if it does not apply to human beings. You create a false view of man, that man is really no different than an animal. Then you create an economic system for two-legged animals, and then you say that that's called economics. But it's not economics. Economics is the science of how man, as a species, transforms the universe. Because no other species does what man does. No other species not only interacts with the universe, all species do, but man changes the universe itself. When human beings make a discovery of a universal physical principle, the universe changes. Gravity, for example, existed before Kepler discovered it. The planets and the moving according to the principle of universal gravitation, long before Kepler discovered the principle of universal gravitation. But when Kepler discovered the principle of universal gravitation, the universe changed. Because prior to that discovery, universal gravitation existed, but it was not part of human practice. Once it had been discovered, now universal gravitation becomes part of human practice. Now, this concept was recognized initially by, as I say, at least in written history, by the Greeks. And Greek culture made a unique contribution to human development, which is not important because it's Greek, but it's important because the Greeks are important because they made this contribution to all mankind, which is what you have developing in classical Greece. It's for the first time in human history, the self-conscious idea of an idea. The idea of ideas themselves. And this idea of the idea is expressed in many ways, but the classic example of this is the discussion in Pythagorean geometry, particularly as discussed in Plato, of the relationship of the doubling of the line, square, and cube. Now, most people here will talk about this a lot, so I'm not going to go into too much detail about it. But I will reference that the way this comes up, for example, is reported in Greek science, is in the form of the so-called Delian paradox. The Delian paradox, the story that is told by Eratosthenes, is that the people of Delos were facing a plague, and they went to the oracle and they asked them what to do about the plague, and the oracle said, build an altar double the size, and that meant doubling the cube, and they went to Plato and asked him, how do we double the cube, and Plato said, you Delians don't realize that the gods don't really care about a double cube, they simply are making fun of you Greeks, because had you been paying attention to geometry, you would not have gotten yourself into this economic crisis in the first place. Sure. Now, later in the Laws, the last thing Plato wrote, which is written after, after Plato tried to get the Athenians to recognize that the execution of Socrates was not only a mistake, but to turn that horrible act into an opportunity to change Athenian culture altogether. He did that with his early dialogues and after his collaborations with Archytas. And towards the end of his life, when he saw Athens sinking deeper and deeper into sophistry, he wrote the longest of all his dialogues, which is called the Laws. He was about to die, and he figures, okay, these guys still haven't got it, so I'm going to give them one more shot. And in the Laws, the dialogue is between, Socrates is not in the dialogue, it's between three people who don't have names. They're just referred to, one is referred to as an Athenian stranger, the other is somebody from Sparta, and the other is somebody from Crete. And these three individuals talk for at length about what society should do, what should be the direction of society. And in the Laws, among the things that Plato talks about, he says, one of the most important things is that people have to be able to understand the thinking of the difference between the line, square, and cube. And he said, best learned while you're a child to play. But he said, people who do not learn this, he said, like the Athenians today, are like more like guzzling swine than they are like human beings. Now, if you, as most of you who organize know, you go out in the street and you ask somebody, how do you double the square? You find somebody who fits the characteristic of more like a guzzling swine than a human being. Now, fortunately for Plato, he did not think that that's what people were. And he recognized that it actually was, you could change people. And he demonstrated this very polemically in the Meno dialogue, where you have this discussion between Socrates and Meno. Meno is arguing, is an oligarch, basically an aristocrat, and Socrates devastates Meno's argument by taking an illiterate slave boy and showing that simply by asking the slave boy questions, the slave boy can discover of his own accord what is the relationship of the doubling of the square, how you double the square. Now, and most of you know that, so I'm not going to go through the example. And then, of course, the next example comes in, which is the question of doubling the cube. And if you work through the construction of Archytas, you see how doubling the cube requires a completely different approach. But what the general principle here that's illustrative of the question of the doubling of the line, square, and cube, the general principle is this idea that Plato refers to in the Theaetetus dialogue as the concept of palus, which is what's relevant to economics. And that is this. When you look at this question of the doubling the line, square, and cube, you can demonstrate that the method to double the square is different than that which is used to double the line. The method to double the cube is different than the method to double the square. But what is more important, what is even more important, is not just that the method is different, but that when you try and express the principle that doubles the line or the square from the standpoint of the principle that doubles the line, it's inexpressible. That is, the diagonal of the square cannot be expressed in terms that are associated with the side of the square. And the Pythagoreans or the Greeks call this principle incommensurability. Now, it doesn't mean, obviously, that the diagonal of the square doesn't exist. It doesn't mean that it isn't a line. If you look at a square and you draw the diagonal is just as much a line as the side. And the diagonal of the square looks just like the side. There's no, you can't tell the difference between the diagonal of the square and the side of the square by looking at them. There's no way to know the difference. Yet, when you try and express the diagonal of the square in terms of the side, you can't do it. And so you recognize that these two things, which appear visibly exactly the same, are of two different species. They have two different species, which the Greeks call palus. And if you look at the line, the doubling of the cube, you see that the side of a cube whose volume is double is of a still different species. So the Greeks early on recognized this question of these different species of magnitudes by which you could not measure one action by a lower action, but you can measure the lower action by the higher action. That is, you can express the doubling of the square of the line from the standpoint of the square, but you can't express the doubling of the square from the standpoint of the line. You can express the square from the standpoint of the cube, but you can't express the cube from the standpoint of the square. And it wasn't until really the 15th century with Nicholas of Cusa that it became clear that there was a still higher species of magnitude, which is the species of magnitude associated with the circle and the diameter of the circle, or which Cusa calls the quantity associated with the difference between the curved and the straight. And the Greeks recognized that this was a incommensurability, but what they didn't recognize was that it was a completely different type of species of incommensurability than the cube and the square. And so, which Leibniz later gave the modern names that we use to associate with these different incommensurabilities, concept of algebraic magnitudes. And the algebraic magnitudes are magnitudes such as that associated with the doubling of the square, the doubling of the cube, and so forth. And transcendental magnitudes, which are associated with the doubling, with the relationship of the curve and the straight. And I guess tonight we're doing the thing on the catenary?
Yes.
Okay. So tonight we'll also discuss more this question of these transcendental relationships. So I'll leave that detail of that discussion to that presentation. Now, the relevance of this concept from the standpoint of economics is that, excuse me, this is what we are looking at when we're looking at the question of the, when we're looking at what we have to understand when we're looking about economics. Because when you're trying to measure economic potential, you, on the one hand, you when you're measuring the increase in population, you're measuring the effect of a process which cannot be directly measured simply by the number of people. That is, what you have to measure is something more than just the number of people, but you have to measure or understand or affect the ability of that of those people to increase the potential for economic development. Now, LaRouche has emphasized in most of his work that in order to fully understand this, the best way to understand this is to be able to look at it from the standpoint of the work of Johannes Kepler as the paradigm for how you look at economics. And what Kepler, and from Kepler's standpoint of the determination of universal gravitation. Now, and as most of you know who have read LaRouche's writings and done the work, that Kepler was unique. Because Kepler, as Kepler points out in The New Astronomy, Kepler differentiated, or had a dispute, he points out in The New Astronomy, the problem which is relevant for economics, which is the difference between Tycho Brahe, Copernicus, and Ptolemy. Three radically different views of how the solar system works, which are not determined by how the solar system looks. This is a difference between how things work and how things look. And this, of course, again, is very relevant for economics, because most people try and concern themselves with how the economy looks as opposed to how the economy works. And so they think in terms of how the things look. And usually the way they define how things look is, how does it look to me? I got money, so the economy is doing fine. I don't have money, so the economy is not doing fine. Or what's actually more common is, I don't have money, but I see people who have money. So the economy must be doing fine. I just haven't figured out, I have to get some of what other people have. Right? But they're thinking about how things look as opposed to how things actually work. So we go out and try and organize people about what's happening with the economy, and they say, it looks good to me. But the reason why they say that is not because it actually looks good to them, but because they want to believe it looks good to them, because if they understood how it worked, they'd be scared shitless about what they're actually facing. And since they don't want to face that fear, they say, well, it looks good to me. And you say, well, how does it look to you? And you say, well, you know, I see lots of rich people around. And, you know, so obviously if people are getting rich, I should be... That I can get rich too. I just have to. It's like the idiot who goes in and plays the lottery, and he says, you know, and he loses. He loses all his money every week. He goes into the casino, or he goes puts money in the lottery, and he loses every week. And he says, well, why do you keep wasting your money on the lottery? He says, because I know I can win if I just have the right number. So the person. The person is going on what look. Somebody has to win. So if I could just get the right number, I could win the lottery. So we have to. As scientists, we have to understand what the difference is between the way things look and the way things actually work. Now, the paradigm for this is to understand is Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation. That's the best place to get the sense of how this method of science. Because when you go out and you look at the night sky, you see, as Kepler points out in the opening of the new astronomy, when you go out and look at the night sky, what you see is the stars, all the stars, appear as if they're painted on the inside of a great sphere whose size is unknown to you. What you see is that when you go out and you look at the sky, you can see the relationship, you see objects around you in on the ground and on the earth, but then you see that these dots of light on the night sky appear to be very far away. And they all appear to be the same distance away, which is very far. So you don't know how far they are, but they all appear to be so far away that they appear to be equidistant from you as the observer. And no matter where you go on the surface of the earth, that visual relationship to you doesn't change. And you get run into this paradox because you have two observers standing right next to each other. And one of them says, I see all these stars equidistant from me. And the other person says, I see all these stars equidistant from me. So each person thinks they're at the center of this great sphere, which is where the idea of the sphere comes from. The idea of the sphere does not come from a geometry textbook. The idea of a sphere comes from the experience of going out and looking at the universe and seeing, how does it appear to you? It appears this great dots of light, and on the and they all seem to be equidistant from you. And then you say, well, how do I describe the universe? You describe the universe as being an object in which it has a center and a surface which is everywhere equidistant from the center. And you call that idea a sphere. The Greeks call it a sphere. And in most of our in the European languages, we still use that word, the Greek word. In almost every language, they just incorporated the Greek word sphere as the name for the way in which the universe appears to us to be visually. Now, when you look at the night sky, you go out and you look at the night sky, and you begin to observe these motions, you see that the stars appear to be moving on this sphere in circular arcs. And as Kepler describes it in the opening of the new astronomy, he says, it's the first assumption of reason that these objects are moving in perfect circles. And not only are they moving in perfect circles, but as he also points out, they appear to be, that you observe over time, he says it's the testimony of the ages, that these motions are what he called, are orbicular. That is, they have a beginning, they move, and they come back to the same place again. Now, when you go out and you look at the night sky, some of this happens over the course of the night. The stars rise and move in a circular arc and set. And then there are some stars which move in a circular arc. They never set, you know, the ones around the circumpolar stars. And they just go around over the course of the night. So if you observe the stars on a clear night for the entire night, you'll see the motions of the stars, all the stars in a circular arc. So now you have two spheres, actually, that you're looking at. One sphere is the sphere that you're at the center of, whose pole is right above your head, and whose horizon, whose equator is the horizon. But then you have another sphere, which seems to be rotating inside of it, which is the sphere on which all the stars are. They're rotating around a different pole. And you get these image of these two different spheres, but they all seem to be perfectly circular. Now, However, there's another phenomenon that Kepler points out. He says, however, on further examination, these motions, some of these motions appear not to be moving in perfect circles. And what he's referring to there, which Plato refers to in the Timaeus as the difference between this, what he calls the circle of the same and the circle of the other. When you look at the motion of the stars, almost all of them appear to be moving in these perfect circles. And they appear to be moving in the perfect circles all in the same direction, from east to west. But from night to night, a few of these stars move in the opposite direction, from west to east. And those stars the Greeks named planets, because the Greek word for wanderer is planeta. And these stars move not only from west to east over the course of from night to night, but that at various times they move, well, let's put it this way, they move irregularly from east to west. That is, sometimes they appear low in the sky and very bright and very close, and sometimes they appear high in the sky and very small and very far away. And that these planets also do something else, which is that from time to time, instead of moving from west to east, they move from east to west. And then they turn around and move from west to east again. So they make these loops in the sky. So Mars just completed one of these loops, which began in late November and ended in late January. Now it's moving west to east again. So this happens from time to time, periodically, for each one of these planets. So now you have a paradox. You have most of the stars moving, appearing to move in perfect circles on the inside of the sphere, and then you have a small number of these stars, which all are moving in the which make these wild gyrations, and we don't, that don't conform to that. So the way Kepler describes this is he says, okay, he says it's the first assumption of reason that these are moving in perfect circles. Then you find out that they're not. And this, he says, gives rise to a powerful sense of wonder which drives men to look into causes. And that statement right there is probably one of the clearest statements of what real economics is that's ever been made. Because Kepler is saying that this is how economic progress occurs. Because when human beings are confronted with a paradox, which is a paradox of reason, it's not a paradox within the domain of sense perception. You don't see the stars move in circles. You don't see a sphere. What you see is just light and dark. But it's an assumption of reason that this is a sphere. It's an assumption of reason that they're moving in perfect circles. Then your reason also discovers something else, which is that there's a contradictory motion. And that contradictory motion creates a paradox in the mind, which creates a powerful sense of wonder and drives men to look into causes. Now, why does it produce that effect in a human being? Not because the human being has two different things that it's observing, because why can't the universe have things moving in perfect circles and moving not in perfect circles? Why should that cause a contradiction? Why should that cause a paradox? It causes a paradox because what's essential about the way the human mind conceives ideas is that it always conceives ideas with respect to a concept of the universe, not as individual ideas. So we recognize things as a contradiction because there's a because we have a concept of the universe which is not a single universal concept. We have two concepts which we don't have a universalizing principle in our mind which unifies these into a single idea. Riemann, in his Philosophical Fragments, makes a very important point which he's paraphrasing Herbart. And he says, you know, all ideas begin with this kind of process as a contradiction. But the contradiction is a contradiction between the way we think the universe should work and what we our experimental evidence shows us. And when we experimentally determine that there's something happening in the universe which contradicts our concept of the universe as a whole, it forces us, compels us, not to make a specific discovery, but to change our view of the universe. And he says, sometimes these ideas become so commonplace that they get communicated, that they get incorporated into our language, and they get communicated, we're no longer conscious of what the original contradiction is, like the example I gave with the sphere. People think today, when you think of a sphere, you think of a geometrical object without any recognition in your mind as to what contradiction ultimately led to the determination of that idea of the sphere. Now, so Kepler points this out, that you have this paradox of reason, and you get these planetary motions. Now, what Kepler emphasizes in the new astronomy is that in his day you had already three wildly different concepts of the universe to explain these contradictory motions. One was the idea of Ptolemy, which was that the universe is the way it appears. That is, the Earth is standing still, and the planets and the stars are all moving around the Earth in perfect circles. The other view is the view of Tycho Brahe, which was that the planets all move around the Sun, and the Sun and all the planets move around the Earth. And the third view was the view of Copernicus, which is that the Earth was actually moving, and the planets were moving too, and the Sun was at the center, but they were all moving in perfect circles. Now, the Copernican view was not what some people think was the more recent view, but the Copernican view was actually the oldest one, because we know Archimedes reports that Aristarchus already had the Copernican, the idea of a heliocentric solar system. But we also know from archaeological evidence that all ancient maritime cultures ultimately understood this heliocentric view. The problem is that you could never possibly determine this by sense perception. You could never see, you're on the Earth. If the Earth is moving, you can't see it moving because you're standing on it. So the only way to determine that whether the Earth is moving or the Sun is moving is through reason, is through your mind. Now, the objection Kepler has, and the paradox he poses in the new astronomy, is that when you look at these three radically different systems, the Copernican system, the Ptolemaic system, and the Tychonic system, all three, when you use these systems to measure the actual motions, produce exactly the same results. Exactly the same results. As he says, within a hair's breadth. So how do you know which one is true? And Kepler said, and of course, Kepler hit the nail on the head and pointed out the real vulnerability of this problem, because Copernicus, Tycho Brahe, and Ptolemy all had one common failing, which is that they all said you can't know what's really true. All you can do is describe a system and say that this system is the one that I adhere to. And this, again, is totally relevant for economics, because that's the way people think of economics. They think you have economic systems, like the Ptolemaic system, the Copernican system, or the Tychonic system.
And it doesn't matter, there's no way to know which system is true, it's just which one you decide to adhere to. Kepler said, I come to reform astronomy. I come to make a completely different approach. My job is to start with a completely different approach, and instead of trying to describe the appearances, I'm going to look at what are the causes. Well, this was quite revolutionary, because from the time of the murder of Archimedes in 231 BC to Kepler, or to Kuza, really, who Kepler was a follower of, everybody had accepted the dogma that you could not actually know the causes. But Kepler said, because you can't see the causes, you can't see the planets moving, where they're moving around the sun, how can you know these? And Ptolemy says this in the opening of the Almagest. He says, I agree with Aristotle. You cannot ultimately know anything about physics, because physical processes you know by sense perception, and since you can't actually see what causes things, you can't know physical principles, you can't know anything about God, because God is beyond human comprehension. Therefore, as far as Aristotle is concerned, you can only know mathematical knowledge. That is something that is defined as a system of rules and procedures. So Kepler says, that's a bunch of bullshit. Kepler says, no, you can start with the physical causes. And how do you start with these physical causes? You start with the physical causes based on knowing that you can determine the physical causes because man has the creative power itself, because you are even asking that question. And the first question you have to ask is, what is it about the universe that this universe produces human beings who are capable of investigating the question of what is the nature of the universe itself? So the fact that we exist is experimental evidence. We exist to ask that question. Is the experimental evidence that you can know something about the causes? Because otherwise, the universe wouldn't have produced that capability of man. So Kepler puts it more poetically, right? He says, it's as if God looked to man, who was yet to be, and constructed man according to those principles, constructed the universe according to those principles that man, who he was going to construct, would find beautiful. And then he made man with the capability of discovering beauty so that man could discover the principles God created the universe by and then participate and develop the creation. That's the way Kepler puts it. It's much more poetic. He says it's as if nature imitates art, not art imitating nature. Kepler does the real hard scientific work, and this is absolutely relevant for economics and very, very crucial for people understanding what we're doing. And as I mentioned last night, and you'll be hearing more about this, and some of you will be participating in it, of course, which is that LaRouche has launched a major project to try and develop economics, study of economics, based on the kind of work that Kepler does. This is expressing itself in our work, in our efforts to create a economics animations to illustrate how a real economy works. Because what does Kepler have? What does Kepler have? He says, I'm going to talk about what the planets are actually doing, what's really going on with astronomy. But, he says, what do you base this hypothesis on? Well, what you have is observations. And what are the observations that an astronomer has, say, in Kepler's case, to study the motion of the planet Mars? What you have is the relative positions of the Earth, Sun, and Mars, and the fixed stars relative to you. In other words, you don't see Mars directly moving around the Sun. You don't see Earth moving around the Sun. What you see is relative positions, that is where Mars appears to an observer on Earth where the sun appears to that observer at the same time and where the fixed stars appear relative to that observer at the same time. So you know the relative positions of the Earth, Sun, and Mars as two angles on the inside of a celestial sphere. Rotation this way and rotation this way. And you have basically two numbers for each position. So you have the relative positions of these things, which are basically these different numbers. That's all you have. That's what in economics research is called data. It's just the data. It's not the reality. But that data reflects a reality that you cannot see. So how do you go from that data to determining what the reality is, which is causing that data to behave the way it is? You can't find it in the data. That's what Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe did. They did what economists today do, or statisticians do, is they take this data and they created a curve for it. They plotted it on a graph. And of course, what do you plot? You're not plotting lines or curves, you're plotting points. Disjointed points. And then you figure out how to connect those disjointed points to each other. Well, if you think about it, you could have, you know, 3 points, and I can connect them this with a curve like that, I can connect them with a curve like this, I can connect them with a curve that goes like this. Right? You can connect, there's an infinite number of curves that are all wildly different that will connect 3 dots, or 5 dots, or 20 dots. So you can't know anything simply by connecting dots, which is what modern economics does. You know something by forgetting the dots in the first place, and starting with a hypothesis. And Kepler's hypothesis is, okay, let's start with what is causing the motion of the planets. And here he says something which is extremely ironic for a scientist. He says, well, what's causing the planets is a principle. To move is a principle. He uses the term species. Species is a Latin word for the Greek word idea. The Latins translated the Greek word idea into the term species, which is still reflected in our use of the term species. When you think of a species of animal, you think of different, what is the unifying idea that expresses the characteristic of the species? So he said, basically, the planets are moved by an idea. Now, the difference between this idea and a human idea is it's not a willful idea. Right? It's not a voluntary idea, but it's an idea nevertheless in the sense that it expresses an intention. It expresses the intention of God to move the planets in this way. So Kepler says, I can determine what that idea is, and he gave that idea a name called gravitation. The idea that Newton discovered gravity is ridiculous. Newton didn't discover anything. The idea of gravitation is that it's an idea, the principle, which is moving the planets. Then Kepler says, now I can discover, I ask the question, what are the characteristics of this idea? And it, in this case, is very much like a human idea, because ideas are not words. But ideas are communicated through words. Ideas exist in your mind. How do you communicate an idea from one person to another? Well, in order to communicate an idea from one person to another, you have to use words and language in such a way as to evoke, to inspire the other person to recreate in their mind the ideas which you are saying, which you have produced in yours. And that's how you communicate an idea. Now, since you can never see what the person is doing, you can't get inside their head. You can't look into their head any more than they can look into yours. You can't tell them, look in my ear, and you can see what my idea. You have to evoke this reaction, this response to another person, in another person, by the communication of this idea. Now, since people don't do this today, in our language, you'll notice, that people punctuate their sentences, usually very frequently, by saying, you know what I mean? Because people have no idea that they're actually communicating an idea to the other person. Because usually the other person isn't listening to them at all anyway. Usually what's happening is two people are sitting there talking and one person is saying, okay, I'll give you my bullshit and then you can listen, then I'll listen to yours. Because people are not interested in truth. But Kepler approaches it from a different standpoint. He says, I'm not interested in the bullshit of Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe. I'm interested in what is true. What is the planet actually doing? All right, then he looks at this question, and what are the planets actually doing? And he says, okay, they're being moved by this idea. And now I look at the experimental evidence, which is that the planets are speeding up and slowing down as they move, which means that the reason why they're speeding up and slowing down is because this idea, this principle of gravity, is organized out of the sun. In the initial hypothesis, it says it's a motion, the center of motion is the sun, and the effect of the sun's gravitation diminishes with the distance. So that the further the planet is away from the sun, the slower it's moving, and the closer it gets to the sun, the faster it's moving. So that the planets are in an orbit around the sun, which brings them closer to the sun and farther from the sun as they move around it. I have a little animation here. I don't know if people can see it. Can you see that? Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a little animation, which is a highly exaggerated depiction. And what you're seeing here is this, because the planetary orbits are not that elliptical. They're actually very close to perfect circles. But here's the focus of the ellipse, which is where the sun is. And this yellow ellipse is the planet. And this green line is the distance, measures the distance from the sun to the planet. And you see as the planet moves, as it moves around the sun, its orbit makes it go further and closer to the sun, and so it speeds up as it gets closer and slows down as it's receding. This characteristic of this planetary orbit is that the motion of the planet is always changing. It's never moving at the same speed. Its speed is increasing or decreasing, and depending on where it is in its orbit, and it has a minimum and a maximum speed. And those minimum and maximum speeds are transitions where the planet changes, not from speeding up to slowing down. So the speed on, for example, the speed right before it reaches the minimum distance and the speed right after it reaches the minimum distance are the same speed. But in the first case, it's getting faster when it reaches that speed. And in the second case, it's starting to get slower. So these two points, the planet's motion is always changing. And at these two points, there's a change in the characteristic of change. So Kepler looked at this. He said, "Okay, this is what's actually happening." And then he took this hypothesis and he compared this hypothesis with the actual observed motion, and he was able to demonstrate that the planets were actually moving in these elliptical orbits that were speeding up and slowing down, that were sweeping out equal areas and equal times. And then he asked the question, why these ellipses as opposed to some other ellipse? And he found that if you compare the fastest speed and the slowest speed of neighboring planets, that the ratios of these two speeds, like the slowest speed of Mars with the slowest speed of Mars with the fastest speed of Earth, and the fastest speed of Mars with the slowest speed of Earth, which are the diverge, converging and diverging proportions, that if you looked at the ratios of these speeds to each other, that these ratios corresponded to the very same ratios that you were discovering when you were yesterday when you were singing the Ave Verum and working on the vocal traits. That these are the relationships that the human mind requires in order to communicate ideas. You cannot communicate ideas, musical ideas, using any ratios you want. You can only communicate ideas using the proportions of the well-tempered system of polyphony. And as you found out in your experimental work yesterday, when the chorus, when you sang one voice, you could get the line in tune, and each part could sing their part in tune. And then when you put it together, you had to find your pitches in a different way. Because when you were practicing your part by yourself, you were determining your pitches relative only to your own voice. But when you put it together in a four-voice polyphony, now you have to determine the pitches within your own voice in relationship to the way the other voices are changing. And we saw this, right? When Matt would say, okay, you know, sing your line, and somebody would sing it perfectly in tune, and you put all four together, and they would get off, right? And because singing it by yourself and singing it in the chorus, you find different pitches. But the planets are not individual planets, each acting with the sun one by one. They're acting with the sun together as an entire solar system. So if you look at Kepler's Harmonies of the World, he writes an epilogue about the sun. And Kepler says in there that the solar system has, in the solar system, you have two relationships. One is the relationship of the individual planets to the sun individually. And he likens this to Plato's idea of understanding, which is the Greek word dianoos. And he says, then there's the relationship of the sun to all the planets together, as of course. And that he calls the relation, he says that's like reason, which is the word noos. The noos and dianoos. And so you have this relationship, just like in a chorus, where the chorus, the individual voice has its own relationship to the piece as that voice develops its melodic line over the course of the piece. And then that voice has a relationship to the piece with respect to the other voices. And that forms a polyphonic whole, which has a higher principle. And that's the way you have to look at the solar system. Now, Leibniz introduced something which Kepler posed this question. And Leibniz introduced a concept which is absolutely crucial towards economics, which is can be seen by looking at this elliptical orbit, the difference between this elliptical orbit and a circular orbit. In a circular orbit, the planetary motion is constant, which means that all you're measuring is a change in the angle. Whether the angle, you know, if the planet has to go around 360 degrees, if it goes around 90 degrees, it's gone one-fourth of the way. It's very simple with a circle. But in an elliptical orbit, when the planet goes moves at a certain angle, the amount of arc that it moves for any given angle changes depending on where it is. So the angle between the angle, let's look at the still here, okay. So here I have the planet, the green line. So the amount of arc that's swept out with this angle here is different than when I sweep out that same angle, which would be the planet would be about here. Actually about here. So this arc is different than that arc. And no matter how small an angle you take, if you compare the different lengths of arc for the same angular change, they're all different. So Kepler, and this causes, this creates what has been referred to ever since as the Kepler problem, which is that Kepler showed that you can measure where the planet's been. If you know where it's been, you can measure how much of the planet's orbit that it's traversed. But you cannot measure precisely where the planet will be when the same proportion of orbit has been carried out. The way you measure where it's been, Kepler figured out, was not to measure the planet directly, but to project the position of the planet on the ellipse onto the circle by a perpendicular line. Then to make that line, connect that line with the center of the of this ellipse, and that produces this angle here. And therefore you can measure the planet's motion around the ellipse by a circular angle which is changing non-uniformly. So the angle with respect to the ellipse, Kepler called the true anomaly. The angle of the projection of the elliptical motion onto the circle, Kepler called the eccentric anomaly. And therefore, you instead of measuring the planet's motion directly, you measure its projection. And from its projection, you can measure how it looks. Okay, but the problem is, if we say that the planet moved from this is 1/4 of the planet's orbit, say this is 1/8 of the planet's orbit, where will the planet be when 1/8 of its orbit will be swept out? That Kepler demonstrated could not be done. And he said, in The New Astronomy, he says, since I can't solve this problem, he comes up with a way to approximate it, which is still the best way to approximate that motion. But he said, but I'm not looking for approximations, because I want to know the principle. And since I can't know the principle, I'm going to demand that future mathematicians figure out what the principle is. You don't have a question?
Yeah, I don't quite get it. Okay, let's say at this point it's 1/8 of the ellipse.
Not of the ellipse, 1/8 of the time.
Oh, the time.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So then you say, won't know where the ellipse is going to be in
when
another
1/8 right.
of the time. Okay.
So in other words, if you know that it's here, you can say, well, this area was swept out, and that's 1/8 of the total area of the ellipse. Mm-hmm. So if you know where it is, you can say how much time it took it to get there. But if you... you can't say where it will be when the same amount of time is elapsed. So, or to put it more simply, if you know the position, you can determine the time. But you can't determine the time from the position. I mean, you can't determine the position from the time. You can determine the time from position, but you can't determine position from time. By the mathematical methods that were available to Kepler. Now, Leibniz solved Kepler's problem, but didn't solve Kepler's problem. He solved Kepler's problem by inventing the infinitesimal calculus. He didn't solve Kepler's problem because when you apply the calculus to the ellipse, it didn't work. It pointed to the existence of something that nobody had known had ever discovered before. And the person who discovered what that something was Gauss. Now, Gauss discovered what that something was when he was 14 years old. And throughout his entire life, he never actually wrote too much about it. But he gave lots of indications of it. And he demonstrated that he knew what that something was in 1801. Which is also a scientific principle which is extremely relevant for economics. And that is, in 1801, in January 1801, Gauss, Piazzi, Italian astronomer who had an observatory in Sicily, observed a new object in the sky. And he measured observe this object until from January 1st until February 11th, 42 days. And it went only a small arc in the sky, about 3 degrees. And it kept rising later and later in the night until it stopped rising until after the sun rose. So you couldn't see it anymore. So if you were ever going to find this object again, and I don't know how many people, how much experience anybody here has of looking through a telescope, but if you try and look through a telescope, you go out and you look, you pick out a star in the sky that you can see with your naked eye, then you try and see that star in the telescope, you know, it's hard to find because the telescope narrows your field of vision, mm-hmm. right? So if you want to, now imagine how hard it is to find an object in the sky that you can't see with your naked eye, that you can only see, so therefore you have to know exactly where in the sky to point your telescope, otherwise you'll never see it again. So Piazzi made these observations, and then it disappeared, and then he had to figure out from those observations where in the sky this new object would appear at a time when it would be visible again. So Gauss was 24 years old at the time, and he was working on his book called The Dispositions Arithmeticae, which was a book about mathematics. But he was not known as an astronomer. But Piazzi, after he couldn't find it, sent out letters to all the leading experts in Europe, European astronomers. And he said, okay, see if you can find out where it is. And for most of May, June, and July of that year, everybody, all the top experts, Lagrange, Laplace, all the major astronomers in Europe, tried to find where Sirius was going to be. And they all failed. So eventually they decided to make this problem public. So Gauss was informed by reading about it in the main journal for astronomers at that time, the Astronomical Journal, in August of that year. And in September, he said, here's where you'll be able to find Sirius again. Now, where he was telling people to look was in a completely different place in the sky than all the experts. And I don't know how many of you have been whether you have or not, but in Europe, especially Germany, in September and October, it's cloudy most of the time. So you're lucky if you get a break in the clouds for a few hours to be able to do some astronomical observations. So you don't have that many opportunities to find this. So now, if you're an astronomer who wants to find Sirius, you can either look where the experts are telling you to look, or you can look where Gauss is telling you to look. And you don't have unlimited amount of time to try both. And so, again, Gauss was not known as an astronomer. But sure enough, in October, somebody decided to look where Gauss was saying to look, which was different when all the experts were saying to look. And Sirius was found where Gauss said it would be. Mm-hmm. And that made Gauss very famous. Now, Lynn gave a talk in Bonn, Germany, in 1997, in the fall of 1997. And Lynn said, this was right after the collapse of the Asian markets, the so-called Asian tigers, which everybody had said was the wave of the future. The economies of Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, and so forth were the wave of the future because they were the free trade. They were the up-and-coming free trade country. And then all of a sudden, in the September of 1997, the Asian economies collapsed. And Lynn gave a talk in Bonn, and he said, why was I right about this collapse when everybody else was wrong? He says, for the same reason that Gauss was able to determine the orbit of Sirius. And the reason why Gauss was able to be right when everybody else is wrong is because Gauss was using Kepler's method, and everybody else was using Newton's method. Now, I'm not going to go through all the details of Gauss's method because Jonathan Tenenbaum and I wrote a whole, basically a book about it, which I think you have available here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you guys can work through.
called?
It's called How Gauss Determined the Orbit of Sirius. And it's a fascinating story to figure out how Gauss did it. But what Gauss actually discovered was that Ceres was an asteroid. It was the first asteroid ever observed. And it existed in an orbit between Mars and Jupiter. And right after Ceres was discovered, it was there were three other asteroids which were discovered very quickly, Pallas, Juno, and Vesta. Now, the thing that, however, Gauss in his astronomy book, he makes a little remark which is quite interesting, where Gauss says, well, yeah, I discovered, which he wrote in 1810, 9 years later. He said, well, yeah, I discovered the orbit of Sirius, but I have to tell you that I actually had thought that this problem of how to determine an entire planetary orbit from a small interval of observations was a problem I was going to actually investigate even before I found out that Piazzi had discovered this new object. And because I thought, because it was assumed, it was assumed by mathematicians and astronomers that this problem could not be solved. And I was working on something completely different, and out of my research, I realized that this problem could be solved. But I didn't have time to write it up. And then all of a sudden, I heard about Piazzi's discoveries, and I decided that I would put this idea into practice. So what was it that Gauss was looking at? And this is very relevant to economics. This is actually the crucial thing to economics. Gauss was looking at something that Leibniz talked about with respect to the planetary motion, the elliptical motion, which Leibniz called harmonic motion. Now the reason why I call it harmonic motion is he says when you have a planet moving in this elliptical orbit, the speed of the planet increases arithmetically, while the distance to the sun increases and decreases harmonically. That is, as the speed increases, the distance decreases. As the speed decreases, the distance increases. So there's this inverse relationship, which the Greeks called harmonic.
This is in the planet?
Yeah, this is in the motions of the planets. That is, as the speed, as the distance, as the speed increases, the distance to the planet decreases, to the sun decreases.
Oh, okay.
Right? And as the speed decreases, the distance increases. Okay? Is that inverse relations? The Greeks call that inverse relationship harmonic relationships. Harmonic. Okay. Yeah.
So does that mean when it comes closer to the sun, it moves faster?
When it comes closer, it moves faster.
It moves faster.
Yes.
All right.
And inversely, when it moves faster, it's getting closer. Okay. So then, but also the planet. So there's three types of change in this planetary, in this elliptical orbit. One is a change in angle. The other is a change in speed. And the third is a change in distance. Now, the Greeks associated these different types of change with what they called means. The arithmetic mean, the geometric mean, and the harmonic mean. Now the term mean for the Greeks is the idea of a quantity that's associated with a particular power. So for example, when you have the doubling of the line, the Greeks call that an arithmetic relationship or the arithmetic mean. Because when you increase a line, the differences are all equal. The geometric mean they associated with like the doubling of the square. The diagonal of the square is the geometric mean between the two areas. because it's a different magnitude. The area of 1, the area of 2, and the intervening magnitude is a different magnitude. But that magnitude has the same relationship to the area of 1 as it does to the area of 2. So this they call the geometric mean. And the harmonic mean, they call, they looked at, which was the inverse of the arithmetic mean. Now I think tomorrow, Matt, are you going to do this with the monochord tomorrow? You'll illustrate
yeah,
that?
I okay. want to show people.
Well, huh?
Yeah, yeah, I want to show people.
Okay, good. So tomorrow Matt will show you how this these relationships of the arithmetic, geometric, and harmonic mean come up in music.
And in the time A, it's also discussed the musical
thing. Yeah, well that's the same thing. These are the, that's how they come up. And in fact the Pythagoreans probably discovered this first with respect to music and later with respect to these geometrical relationships.
You're saying they make no distinction between the harmonic and the musical mean?
The harmonic mean is the fourth, what we call the fourth. I don't know what you mean by the musical mean.
But it's basically they have two extremes and they use one arithmetic mean and one...
one harmonic mean. Right.
Two.
You have the harmonic mean and the arithmetic mean, which in music are associated with the fourth and the fifth.
Yeah.
What the geometric mean in music is associated with the Lydian interval. As far as Matt will go through this tomorrow, we'll demonstrate the way these different means show up in music. So again, but I just want to indicate it, so again you can see how these types of relationships, which are governing the motions of the planetary objects, which are non-living, conform to the same harmonic relationships that human beings have to use to communicate ideas through polyphonic music. Again, demonstrating that the human mind is an efficient power in the universe itself. Okay. Now, here's where it gets a little complicated. The thing about the planetary motion is that it as distinguishes from the circular motion is the motion of the planet is speeding up and slowing down and getting closer and farther from the sun. So it's moving around and also closer and further at the same time. So but it's one motion. That is, as the planet rotates, it's getting closer and farther. Right? But what it's not doing is rotating and then getting closer and farther. Or getting closer and farther and then rotating. It's not two different actions. It's one action which has two components. Right? Now, this means that this is different, for example, then in a simple circle, where in the circle you have one component, which is simple angular change. Now, when you have a simple circular motion,
it's dark. Okay, you have a simple circular motion, and here's our angular change, and the angle and the arc are commensurable with each other. Okay, that is, if you rotate, the angle is 1/8 of the entire rotation around the circle, you will have marked off 1/8 of the arc. Okay? But the relationship of the sine of the angle is incommensurable with the arc and the angle. Because here we say this is 1/2 the rotation from 0 to 90 degrees. Obviously the sine has grown more than 1/2. So there's an incommensurability between the sine with the angle and the arc, but the angle and the arc are commensurable.
Why is the sine incommensurable?
Because the way the increase and decrease of the sign increases at a different proportion than the angle increase. Okay.
It can be a commensurate. Yeah, but not proportional.
It's not commensurable.
If it's not proportional.
Yeah. It's the same thing, the proportionality and commensurability. It's a different type of proportion.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Now, the problem is that when you have the elliptical motion, that proportionality, you get a double incommensurability. Because the sine is incommensurable with the angle, and it's incommensurable with the arc in a different way. So you have two incommensurabilities acting together. So prior to Gauss, people couldn't figure out how to solve this problem. But Gauss realized that the way you solve this problem is by recognizing that this elliptical motion is associated with a different type of quantity. And that quantity, Gauss called a new transcendental. And sometimes it's called an elliptical transcendental. And then he showed something else, which is that when you look at these previous, the circular motion, that this is associated with the arithmetic, the geometric, and the harmonic means, that this new transcendental is the effect of a new type of mean, which he called the arithmetic geometric mean. Or sometimes we call it the arithmetico-geometric mean. Now the arithmetic-geometric mean is not the arithmetic mean, and it's not the geometric mean. It's a new type of number, what he called a new transcendental number. Sometimes it's called an elliptical function. And the way, what the arithmetic-geometric mean is if you have the arithmetic, you take the arithmetic mean, and you take the geometric mean, and then you take the arithmetic and geometric mean of those two means, and the arithmetic and geometric mean of those two means, and that gets you closer and closer to a particular mean. Now I'll give you an example of how this is applied to planetary orbits. Yeah.
What's an arithmetical and mathematical mean?
Geometric. The arithmetic and the geometric mean.
Yeah, what's that?
The arithmetic mean is that associated with the line. And the geometric mean is associated with the rotation. So, for example, if you have 1 to 2, you have a line of 1 and a line of 2. What's the mean between a line of 1 and a line of 2? That is, what is the length of a line whose relationship, which is exactly the mean between 1 and 2. Well, in the case of the line, that would be a line of 3 halves. And that's the mean between 1 and 2. Whereas the geometric mean between 1 and 2 is the line that is the side of the square, that is the edge of the square whose areas are in proportion 1 to 2. To be like, you have the square of 1 and the diagonal of that square, and that becomes the side of the square whose area is 2, the length of that line is the geometric mean, which is not 3 halves, it's something sometimes people call the square root of 2. But the square root of 2 is a stupid name. The square root of 2 is simply the side of the square whose area is 2. But the square root of 2 doesn't exist unless you have a square of 1 and a square of 2, and it's the geometric mean between 1 and 2. So the arithmetic mean between 1 and 2 is 3 halves. The geometric mean is what sometimes people call the square root of 2. The arithmetic geometric mean, to find the arithmetic geometric mean, you find the arithmetic mean between 1 and 2, and then you find the geometric mean between 1 and 2. Then you find the arithmetic mean between those two means, and you find the geometric mean between those two means. And then you find the arithmetic mean between those two means and the geometric mean between those two means. and that rapidly converges on a magnitude, which is a transcendental number, which expresses the relationship of elliptical functions. So I'll give you an example, okay? Here's an ellipse, and in any ellipse you have a major axis, which is the long axis, and you have a minor axis, which is the short axis. Right? And so if you take the major axis of this ellipse and the minor axis of that ellipse, and you take the arithmetic mean between the major axis and the minor axis, and then you can take the geometric mean between the major axis and the minor axis. So that defines a new ellipse, whose major axis is the arithmetic mean of the axes of this ellipse, and whose minor axis is the geometric mean between the two axes of that ellipse. And if you do that, if you take the arithmetic, if you make a new ellipse based on the arithmetic and geometric mean of these two axes, you get an ellipse that looks like that. It's closer to a circle, right? But it's not a circle, it's still an ellipse. Now you can take the arithmetic and geometric mean between these axes and make a new ellipse which is close, still even closer to a circle. Then you can take the arithmetic geometric mean again, and you get closer and closer to a circle whose radius is this arithmetic geometric mean of this ellipse. And then you could go the other way. You could go back to this ellipse, and you can find what is the ellipse whose major and minor axis, whose arithmetic mean between its major and minor axis is this length, and whose geometric mean is that. So that ellipse would look like that. So on the one side, you get closer and closer to a line, and on the other side, you get closer and closer to a circle. And what you have in between is a discontinuous series of ellipses, right, which are related to each other because they're the arithmetic geometric means of each other. Now, the interesting thing that Gauss discovered, as you can see that these ellipses are quite different. Here I have an animated motion. Here's the planetary motion of that ellipse. And here's the motion of a planet around an ellipse formed from the arithmetic geometric mean of that one. It's much different, right? Mm-hmm. But what Gauss showed is that there's something which is the same in both these ellipses. Right, everyone. Okay, here we have them compared. And here you have them moving. You see them side by side, and you see how different they are. Right? But here's what doesn't change. If you take this length of this line, of the green line, which is the line that connects the planet to the center of the ellipse, and you compare that length, how that length changes, proportional to this angle that the white line makes with the center, that relationship doesn't change from one ellipse to the other, which are related to each other by the arithmetic geometric mean. And I'll show you that. Okay. So here's the one, here's the other direction. So you see these goes in the other direction. There's a big variation in the way this moves. It gets very long and very short and very long and very short. Whereas the one with the circle doesn't vary very much. The one in the middle varies a medium amount. And here you have the two together. Now, this is a chart, and you can see this is how we do real economics. This is a chart which compares the angle along this axis and the rate of change of the radius along this axis. So this is the curve for the medium ellipse. This is the curve for the one that looks more like a circle. There's not as much change. and this is the curve for the one that's long and skinny. You see, there's a lot of change.
What does that measure again?
The angle along this weight and the rate of change in this direction. And then, when you put all three together, you see the overall effect is exactly the same.
That axis in the bottom, what is that?
Angle. That's the angle.
So it's a variation according to the angle.
Mm-hmm. The rate of change.
In what? Change of what?
The radius.
Okay.
Relative to the angle. Okay. Now, here's another ellipse, which you see in this case, this ellipse over here looks more like this one than the other two that I showed you. But when you make the same comparison, you get, that's this purple line, you see it's completely different. So what Gauss discovered with this elliptical function called the arithmetic geometric mean is a new form of transcendental function which connects things which seem to be completely unconnected. Now, the relevance of this for economics is that this arithmetic geometric mean is a quantity, it's a number. It's a relationship. But it's a relationship which has a very interesting characteristic. Because it's a relationship not of a single action, but of a single action that is produced by a combination of two incommensurables. Now, this is the kind of mathematics that is necessary to understand economics. Because when you're looking at economics, economic process, what are you looking at? Take, for example, start with the household. Because the household is the basic economic unit. There's no economic unit less than a single household. Though some households might only have one person in it. But it's still a household. The economic, what is the purpose of the household from the standpoint of the economy? The purpose of a household from the standpoint of an economy is to produce human beings that are capable of increasing the potential of the economic development. Now that, in the case of a one-person household, is the ability to contribute economic potential of that single individual. In the case of a family, it's obviously the economic potential of the adults in the family, which the household has, is producing children who, unlike in most households today, are supposed to be better than their parents. Of course, most parents, including baby, especially baby boomers, they don't think the children are supposed to be better. Mm-hmm. Maybe the children are a pain in the ass. And if anything, they're just supposed to get out of the way. But, goes into what is necessary for that household to be able to perform that economic function? What does it take? Well, it takes a house. And the difference between a shack and an actual house with living conditions that are suitable for intellectual development and the material development of the members of that household are two different things. So you have to have a house which has which materially has enough space in it and enough facilities into it that you can produce an effective economic activity of the members of that household. So that means that requires a certain level of economic activity to produce that quality of housing for your population. That house also has to have water. Running water in it, obviously, if you have running water in the house, that increases the economic, the quality of output, economic output of the members of that household than if you have to go to an outhouse, right? Which is, we obviously know that indoor plumbing was a major advance in human civilization. and not only bringing indoor plumbing in, indoor water in, but bringing the water, having a sewer system so that the you can maintain proper sanitary conditions in that house. The house has to have electricity. The house has to have be able to have the appliances and ability to cook food. So you can keep going on, right? And you see that in order to maintain, in order to have the economic output of a single household, when we talk about the economic output of a single household, we're not talking about the amount of money that comes into the household. We're talking about the amount of ideas which come out of the household. The quality and quantity of ideas which that household produces requires a degree of material and cultural input which defines your level of economic infrastructure, both physical economic, hard physical economic infrastructure such as power, water, industry, so forth, and your so-called soft infrastructure such as healthcare, education, access to cultural levels, and so on and so on and so forth, right? So when you begin to think about an economic process, you're thinking about a single action, that is the production of ideas, which is the effect of a very large number of processes, which like the arithmetic, geometric, mean, motion of an ellipse, are all interacting to produce a single effect, right? So Gauss extended this idea. The only appropriate concept for this is the extension Gauss gave of this elliptical function, which is that in the case of the elliptical functions, we've got two principles interacting to produce a single effect. And Gauss said, well, this is just the first step, that there's actually a whole hierarchy of such functions, which are the result of multiplicity of principles acting to produce a single effect. And he called those types of functions hypergeometries. And they're defined by what Gauss and Riemann later called the hypergeometric functions. And these hypergeometric functions are distinguished from one another by the number of principles which produce that single effect. So in order to understand economics, you cannot look at individual things like the rate of production of steel, cars, food, etc., etc. What you actually have to look at is the economy as a hypergeometric function. Yeah.
Now, when we know that we're understanding all the principles that are involved into making things?
You don't. What you know is you know the principles you know. And then you investigate the economy based on the principles you know.
So you could still be wrong in your actions towards bettering the economy.
No, you won't be wrong. You'll just be incomplete. And then what you do is you make a new discovery. You're not wrong.
Because a fraction of principles can be contradictory to the whole.
Right.
Okay.
When you find the contradiction, that indicates to you something that's missing. That's the way science works. See, the argument that you'll be wrong is the argument that was used by Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe, that since any scientific discovery is always superseded by another scientific discovery, that means all scientific discoveries are inherently incorrect. There are scientific discoveries which are incorrect. Those are the ones that are associated with Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe. But they're not incorrect because of what they say, they're incorrect of where they come from. So science is that the scientific, if you look at it on the other hand from the standpoint of Kepler, and this is why Kepler is probably one of the most important scientists to discover, because Kepler's whole life is spent making a discovery and then immediately turning on that discovery and saying, okay, what is now that I've made this discovery, I can now see what I don't know. And that defines a new discovery. And that defines the need for a new discovery, and that defines the need for a new discovery, and so on and so forth. Yeah?
So what do we don't know today in terms of science of physical economy? What fundamental questions are still unanswered by what we already know?
Well, the begin with this question of how do we define a new relationship of man to the physical universe, to resources. We have already certain directions, right? We know from use of fission and fusion and so forth. But, you know, if we're going to do the kinds of things we talked about last night, colonizing Mars and going out and Earth-forming Titan and all these kinds of things, this is going to require the harnessing of a whole series of principles like matter-antimatter reactions and all kinds of things, which we have to discover. What we know about the science of physical economy is we know it's the relationship between the creative powers of the mind and the physical principles. This idea of the Lynn talks about. But
is physical economy as a science, I can't conceive that it's already fully developed, like that nothing else can be added to the theory of physical economy.
No, nothing can be added to it except when we go out and develop and actually develop the physical economy, then we'll find new things about the relationship of man to nature, which right now we're not aware. They won't contradict what we know in terms of the nature of man, but they will add to it things that, they will add to it a dimensionality, a characteristic, which we right now cannot conceive of.
So it's a problem that we never had in history of our modern history, period, long enough where we apply these principles.
Correct.
Of the economy to see the contradiction pops or these
things. Right. Well, because man has always lived, not just in modern history, but the human race has, for our entire history, has lived with this contradiction between imperialism and what you could call the humanist idea, right? There's no reason why we have to have that duality. Man can grow up and eliminate imperialism from the planet. There's no need for it. Just like LaRouche said, there's no need for war anymore. There's no need for oligarchs. It's not like because we've had oligarchs for all human existence that we have to have oligarchs for the rest of human existence. There's really no need for them. We've now reached the level of maturity and we've now learned the lesson of history that we can confidently eliminate oligarchism from human society and know we're not going to miss anything.
Just chop some heads.
No, you don't chop their heads. You just put them in a zoo or something. And the point is that Lynn put it really poetically once, or maybe it was Helga who said it, that the human race has basically been from the Greek times to the present in a state of adolescence. You know, in adolescence, when you're a child, you don't really have control over yourself, right? You do all kinds of crazy things. Mm-hmm. When you're an adolescent, you know, for 1 minute you're a child, and the next minute you're an adult. You're sort of in between. It's why adolescence is pretty much controlled insanity. But then at a certain point, you leave adolescence, or at least healthy people do, except for boomers, right? You leave adolescence and you become an adult, and you know it. And that's why this period of 18 to 25 years of age is such an important period in people's lives, because you're emotionally an adult. That is, emotionally you've decided you're no longer a child, but you still have the enthusiasm and energy and curiosity and so forth that you have when you're a child. So that's why that period is so important. And And so mankind is right at that point, where we've sort of been in this adolescent stage of knowing we shouldn't have oligarchs, but capitulating to them. And now we should just become adults and get rid of all these false systems and just develop man. It could, you know, and that's not to say that we, and I'm not taking a Marxist materialist view of history here, that, you know, it was necessary for all the intervening things to happen in order for us to get to this stage. I don't buy that. This could have happened 2,500 years ago if people would have listened to Socrates. But they didn't. So now we have an opportunity to do it again. Man should grow up. Whether man will grow up or not is a voluntary question. It's not a materialist question that we're going to inevitably go through these stages, and if we just wait long enough, man will grow up. The difference is that for the first time in human history, human culture exists as a planetary culture. I don't mean a globalist culture, but this is a planetary culture. And therefore, there's no part of the planet which will survive a dark age. So either we grow up, or the crisis we have, every crisis we're going to have from here on out are going to be planetary crises. You're not going to have, if you look at human history, you've had crises, every civilizational crisis has affected a single civilization at a time. But now, because global civilization is planetary, every crisis is a planetary crisis. So it either affects, it's going to affect all human beings. And that sort of puts the question on the table that it's not a question of some civilizations might grow up and others might not. Either mankind as a whole grows up, or it affects all mankind. Which is another way of saying what Martin Luther King said, if there's injustice anywhere, there's injustice everywhere. Which of course is the, you know, biggest sophistry of globalization, because the globalists say, well, look at the way globalization has improved the conditions of life for, and then they talk about all the people that have benefited from it and cut out all the people whose lives have gotten worse, which are most people. It's sort of like the way they fix the figures in the economic statistics, and they say, well, you know, if you eliminate all the things that are increasing in cost, inflation is low. And of course, all the things that are increasing in cost are the things that most people spend most of their money on. Yeah. Housing, food, and energy. So if you eliminate housing, food, and energy, inflation is very low. But since most people spend most of their money on housing, food, and energy, for most people, inflation is very high. So you see, it's a sophistry.
The notion that the economy is doing well except for employment.
Yeah. Yeah, globalization, you know, you say, well, you know, 50 million people in India are doing better because they work in call centers and, you know, are outsourcing their radiological services. And so that's lifted the standard of living of 50 million people.
With the jobless recovery of Bush?
Yeah, the jobless recovery. Or the one that says employment is up because now everybody has three jobs. So the economy must be doing good because most people I know have three or four jobs. So those are the kinds of things that these are the kinds of scientific principles that the science of physical economy really is based. And those are the things that the youth movement now has to begin to master. Now that you guys have the fundamental theorem of algebra under your belt, and you got the Archytas construction, old hat, and the catenary principle is well known. And you're pretty close to mastering Riemann's abelian functions. You need to get into the hypergeometries. You get it.
I'll do it next week.
No, but this is the cutting edge. This is the forefront of science. This is the frontier of scientific work right now. And it's going to be the frontier of scientific work for the next 50 years. If you look at the thing we did in the Principle of Powers paper on the Einstein-Born correspondence, this is the frontier of science. The problem is that science basically stopped at the beginning of the 20th century. Fundamental science stopped. You had all the discoveries, all the progress in science during the 20th century are based on fundamental discoveries which were made before 1870. But now we're at the point where we've come to the point where we have to go back to where science was in the 1870s, look at all the progress, all the experimental evidence that the development of those ideas has produced, and define in the same way Kepler did, and define the look at these questions anew from the standpoint of these frontiers. Yeah.
I have a question, though, because okay, basically, what about Einstein? Is after 1870?
Yeah. But Einstein is very important. I wrote an article about him, which is I put in the briefing. It's on the website, but it's going to be published in Fidelio. Einstein is important, but he reflects Riemann's ideas, as he himself said. He really reflects the ideas of Riemann and Kepler. And what happened was, if you look at this argument between Einstein and Born, Einstein posed the question both on the microphysical and astrophysical domain that there's a characteristic change characteristic of physical principles in the very small and the very large. And then Einstein, having discovered that and defined those basic some of those questions, spent the rest of his life trying to figure out how that could develop. The problem is that Einstein lived at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. And the dominant culture at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th was bad. It was characterized by existentialism, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, which ultimately led to World War I, World War II, fascism, and everything else, right? So the science capitulated, except for Einstein. Einstein and Planck were really the only two, but Einstein really was key in this. But everybody else capitulated to this pessimism. And this is typified by the so-called Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which says that, yeah, there's a change in the microscopic domain, and that change is that in the macroscopic domain, things are work according to knowable principles, but in the microscopic domain, things are fundamentally random. Yeah, this is Niels Bohr. It's called the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. This is Niels Bohr's, associated with Niels Bohr and also with a guy named Max Born, who was a German. Max Born was one of Einstein's early collaborators, and they were close friends. But Born, in 1920, went over to the Copenhagen School and became an advocate of this idea that that since this new experimental evidence in the microscopic domain can be mathematically expressed using the algebra of probability. That the algebra of probability was not just a approximation of reality, not just a way to approximate and express it, but it was reality. That in the infinitely, in the very small, things were fundamentally random. It's not just that we don't know what they are, so therefore we use probability to try and decide it. It's that the universe doesn't know what it's doing in the infinitely, in the very small. That's what they accepted. Which is a pessimistic view. It's very much like the view of Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Tycho Brahe, which says, since I can't really know what the planets are doing, the universe doesn't know what the planets are doing. The planets don't know what they're doing. Right? What Kepler said is, no, that's not true. The planets are carrying out the intention of God. And I, created in the image of God, can discover what that intention is. Right? Einstein had the view of Kepler and Riemann. And Einstein said, Einstein insisted, God doesn't play dice. Yes, probability statistics might give us a close approximation of what the experimental evidence is, but it's not the truth. And what science must do is seek the truth. And in 1926, all throughout this period, he continued to write letters to Born. And these are preserved in a series of letters that Born published after Einstein's death. And this goes all the way up to Einstein's death in 1955. So they're very interesting because you see two friends who have become intellectual adversaries, who speak quite frankly with each other about their differences in views. Now, Einstein was completely ostracized from about 1920 on, actually from about 1918 on.
Was that ostracized?
He was excluded from the scientific community. He was considered to be a guy who had done great work, but now was, you know, a senile old man who was refusing to accept the new revolutionary physics. And so he became virtually alone in his defense of Riemann. And the word ostracized comes from the Greek word. And when one of the punishments in Greek society was somebody who was considered a problem was to be exiled from the state, exiled from Athens. So ostracism was a form of punishment. Form of exile. So Einstein was exiled from the scientific community, although everybody venerated him because he was the guy who discovered quantum physics and the guy who discovered theory of relativity and everything else. But because they took his discoveries and turned it into this pessimistic, as a justification for pessimism, Einstein objected to that. And so they ostracized him intellectually. He didn't budge. He said, he at one point, and later in his life, he wrote a letter to Born, and he says, I feel as lonely as Leibniz in his argument against Newton on absolute space, but I will never budge from this position. Now, the problem Einstein had is, one, he made these discoveries, but he couldn't, he was able to object, but he was not able to resolve the problem. And one of the reasons why he wasn't able to resolve the problem is because he didn't really have a generation of young scientists he didn't have a single one of these young scientists who he was working with who did not capitulate to his pessimism. So it's really up to our job to create the new generation of scientists which will go back and look at these discoveries and this experimental evidence from this standpoint.
When you say he had a problem, you mean that, like, he had a problem, like, okay, what?
What I mean is that he recognized that the pessimism in society was all screwed up. But all he could do is object to it.
So it's not that he didn't understand scientifically, like he understood what the problem was, like in terms of science, but he wasn't able to influence the culture.
As opposed to Lin, who recognizes the scientific principle, but is also able to go out and influence the culture.
And create a
That's why what we're doing is what will solve these problems, is what will lead to the solution to these problems in science.
Yeah. And were you also saying to that, that the problem with Einstein is that he couldn't prove, he didn't have an answer to quantum physics?
No, he didn't have, but I'm saying there's something more fundamental.
Exactly, well, I think that's what you were saying. He understood it wasn't random, but he did not have the answer. He could just say it's not random, but he didn't...
No, he continued to try and discover the answer.
But he couldn't really...
Solved the problem, but that's not his problem. His problem is not that he didn't solve the problem, because he worked his whole life to try to come up with a solution. That wasn't his problem. That wasn't his failing. The problem is that he wasn't able to change the culture, because he himself didn't really understand these cultural questions, and it really wasn't until much later in his life, when he got to Princeton and then Gödel came to Princeton and the two of them became friends, that he began to get a better sense of how this works. He had you have to take that into account. The brilliance of Lin, who's like Leibniz in that regard, or Plato, or Socrates, is that he not only understands these questions of science, but he's intervening on the culture. And so the problem we had in the 19th and 20th century is that scientists capitulated to the culture, and those who didn't want to capitulate to the culture, all they could do was object. Because I don't fault Einstein for that, because what are you up against? You know, you're up against world synarchy. How many people are going to have the courage to stand up to that? Lin is a very unique person in that regard. Here's the guy who is willing to stand up to world synarchy, even when he had no ability to really stand up to it. But because he stood up to it when he had no ability to stand up to it, he gained the ability to increase, he understood it as a moral question. And you recognize it, you know, and this is the whole, really, which is the issue which comes before the youth movement. People say, well, you can't really, you haven't really, you know, you haven't defeated these guys, so why should you try? But the point is, you say, and you can't defeat it. Who are you? You know, you don't have a degree, you don't have this, you don't have any money, you don't have any power, you're not an oligarch, you know, they come up with things that people throw at us. The point is, if you know it has to be done, and you don't have the power to do it, you use what power you have, and you do everything you can to gain greater influence to the very end to fight for the good. You don't use the fact that you might not be successful or may not have the ability to defeat evil right now for an excuse not to fight evil. It's like, this is the thing you get with these politicians, and you get these, I'm sure you guys have had people come up to you on the street and tell you this, because they tell us all the time, oh, come on, why are you people out here, you know, on the fringe? Why don't you just, you know, go on the inside, you know? Get a job, work in the politician, work through the system, pay your dues, and as you work through the system, you'll get up, you know, to the level of power. And then when you get power, you'll be able to do all the good things you did from within. But if you stay out here on the fringe, you're just going to be out here on the street when you're an old man, and no one's going to pay attention to you, right? Well, you know, a perfect example is of all these politicians, you go back, and they have all these great ideas, and they get more and more power by compromising, and the more power they get, the more compromised they are. So the more power they get, the less able they are to implement the policies they got the power to implement. So you, and Lin likes to paraphrase Eugene Debs, he says, you know, I'd rather vote for the guy I want and lose than vote for the guy I don't want and win. But that's what people do. They say, well, you know, why should I vote for the loser? Why should I go with you guys? You're going to lose. You know, why don't I go with the guy who can win? Well, he's an asshole. Yeah, but he's going to win. So you're, you know, so okay, so your guy will win who's an asshole, and that's what you'll end up with. You win by being by not compromising. LaRouche, if you look at LaRouche, you know, he's always stood up for what's right. People say, well, he's never won the election. But his influence keeps growing. Lincoln, take the history of Lincoln. This is, you know, because it's important you guys understand American history. Lincoln lost most of the elections he ran in. And every time he would win an election, he would lose the next one. Because when he got into office, he used his, he did what he did before he got elected, was he told the truth. And one of the most famous examples of this is the Senate debate in 1858, in which Lincoln expressed something that he was actually talking about all throughout the 1850s and going back to the 1840s when he was a member of Congress. But he expressed this in 1858. He said, "A house divided cannot stand. This country cannot remain half slave and half free. It's either going to be all one or all the other." Now, most people didn't agree with that. They said, why can't it remain half slave and half free? It's been that way since our founding. I don't like slavery, but I don't want to have a war over it. So let's just compromise. We'll let the slave states have one more territory. And that'll be the end. That'll be the end of the expansion of slavery. So why can't it compromise? Why can't it be half slave and half? We'll have the slave states. They'll do what they do. We'll have no slavery. We'll do what we do. You couldn't compromise. But as long as people believed you could compromise, they didn't vote for Lincoln. They'd say, we want to compromise. But when they realized that Lincoln was right, and it was going to be all one or all the other, then they had to go with Lincoln, because if it was going to be all one or all the other, they wanted to make sure it was all free, and they had to go with the guy who was the courage to do it. So this is what people have been saying to Lynn all along. Come on, Lynn, get off your hands. Why don't you think we've got to reorganize the whole moral monetary system? Why don't we just reform it? Why don't you go along with George Soros and reform the monetary system? Why don't you go along with Felix Rohatyn, you know? Come on, we'll let you in on the inside. You can get in with Rohatyn and Soros, and we'll just together, you know, we'll make globalism more human. Right? You guys get this all the time, right? These professors, they come up to you. Why is a smart person like you out on the street with this extremist like LaRouche? Why don't you just, you know... You know, you're really smart. You could go really places, you know? If you just, you know, I know you're young and idealistic, but, you know, if you just get along, get your degree, and get your job, pay your dues, get up there, you know, about 20 years, you'll probably be a pretty influential people and person, and you'll be able to then implement your great ideal. And just look at the baby boomers, and you see what that is. You know, what you start, first of all, you start to lose your ideals. Because every time you compromise, you can't look at yourself in the mirror. Every time you compromise, you have to live with the fact that you compromise. Now, there's some times when you have to compromise because you don't have the power to avoid a compromise. But as long as it's not voluntary, as long as you recognize, okay, I have to make this compromise now because I can't, you know, I don't have the power to defeat this. Right? I have to do something else. I have to look for another flank. You can live with yourself. But you can't live with yourself if you ever compromise your principles. And if you start compromising your principles, then the more you compromise your principles for the sake of a temporary expedience, you lose a bit of your soul. And then when it comes times when you have to fight, you cave in. Yeah.
Now we have but this is not an important problem with that, is that any movement, any radical movement has this attitude. Where, like, you look at Marxists, or you look at anybody, you're convinced, you're holding the truth, and you don't compromise, but then you got a bunch of people not listening to each other.
Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about something that we're convinced of, because we happen to believe it, or this is a doctrine. We're looking at this question from the standpoint of science.
like we don't believe we know?
Yeah. Well, it's not a question of belief. It's a question of what you know.
We don't have faith in Linda and me. We know the guy.
Well, you don't have to know it. It's not a question. You know it. Look at him. Look at his life. Look at what he says. Look what he does. Because LaRouche is not telling you, believe this, believe that, accept what I would say. He's saying, okay, look at the history. Look at the last 40 years of history. Here's what I've said. Here's what the people who said I was wrong say. Who's been right and who's been wrong? You got the experimental evidence. Now, why have I been right and the other guy's been wrong? No secret. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not conjuring up. I don't have a trick method. Like these idiots you see, they have this on late night TV here where the guy says, you know, I have the method by which you guarantee to make money speculating on the foreign exchange market. You just have to know my method. My method works. And then they go, yeah, I bought his method and I made $3,000 in one day. And you know, you get these guys, they got the secret method.
How much did they sell the method?
That's the point. You know, the guy, they show the guy on a big yacht and so forth, you know, I went from dirt poor to a millionaire with my method. Of course, how do you make your money? I sell the method. I don't use it. I just sell people these videotapes. That's where you make your money from, by selling them the videotapes. So it's a question of the as Lynn said, you know, why was Gauss right? Why was I right and other people wrong? Because of how Gauss determined the order of series. That's why what Lynn says to the youth movement is, master Gauss, master Riemann, learn, master Bach, Mozart. These are principles you have to know for yourself. This question of the hypergeometric functions that I've been talking about here, I cannot explain these to you. You have to discover it for yourself. Unless you discover it for yourself, you won't understand it. You won't understand Kepler unless you discover it for yourself, no matter how many classes somebody gives or something you attend.
Mm-hmm.
Or no matter how many times you read Kepler. You have to discover the principle for yourself. And I think everybody who's in the youth movement at least had some experience of this, where you were introduced to something, you didn't understand it, you heard people explain it to you many, many times, and then you went and finally worked it out for yourself, and then you said, now I see what I didn't understand, because you don't know it until you discover it for yourself. You've had that experience. And once you've had that experience, then you have a reference point in your mind for what it means to know something. So that when you come up against something that you don't know, you know that it's of the same type of something that you had previously encountered, that you didn't know, but you finally got the idea. And therefore you have confidence not in what you know, but you have confidence in that process of discovery. And so when you come up against something you don't know, you don't see it as something, you don't approach it with a sense of futility and desperation. You approach it with a sense of, okay, well, this is something which is for me today what doubling the square was in previous times. But I got through that. I'm going to get through something else. So it's your confidence in your mind. You have to develop a self-confidence in the powers of your own mind, which is not a confidence in what you know in terms of facts or even discoveries or what you've done. It's a confidence in the ability of the mind to make those discoveries. And that's why an educational program like the LaRouche Youth Movement is so crucial for the development of competent political leadership. Because you have that kind of experience as a youth, then that lives with you for the rest of your life. And and that's one of the reasons why university education is so lousy. Because they want people to come out of the university not with this sense of intellectual self-confidence, but with that sense of intellectual self-confidence beaten out of you. Then you come out of the university as a pliable drone instead of somebody who has confidence in their ability to discover. So the key to building the youth movement, as Lynn said, is the university on wheels. Why does he put so? He don't want a youth movement of people that are going to go out and pass out pamphlets in the street. You could hire people to do that. The youth movement has developed a political leadership, and that political leadership is developed by going through this intellectual experience. That's why the Bach, the music, the Bach, the Gauss, the Kepler, these are so crucial for the development of your own ability to be political leaders. Because if your political leadership, if you don't succeed as political leaders, civilization doesn't succeed. Like it or not, you're going to be running the world 25 to 30 years from now. Your generation. The boomers are going to be gone. The world's going to be in your hands. And I guarantee you, if we don't do something now, turn it around, it's going to be in shit shape. So, if you're not there to influence and guide and lead your generation, then the human race has no chance of surviving. Yeah.
Do you think Roosevelt made a compromise to get to the president?
Oh, probably. Roosevelt was kind of a brilliant politician, but I don't think he ever compromised his principles.
So do you think people were alive in a position where they didn't have the choice to elect Roosevelt or otherwise they're going down?
Well, I mean, you see, what happened was that Roosevelt was very active in politics. He was the Secretary of the Navy during World War I, and he was the vice presidential candidate in 1920. And then he got polio. So he was on a course to be a major politician. And then he got sick. He got polio, which would have ended any man's career. But Roosevelt took the period of his recuperation to do a detailed study of the history of American presidency, going all the way back to his great-great-grandfather and so forth. And Roosevelt, out of that, looking at the country, realized that he had to get back into politics. And so he strengthened himself, which was really enormously what he did, both intellectually and physically. Any other person would have just said, it's too physically exhausting for me to run, to get back involved in politics. But you remember, nobody even knew that Roosevelt was crippled until after he died. Most of the American people didn't know. He figured out a way to appear to walk by hanging on to his son. And so they practiced this for a long time. You know, he put himself in real serious physical rigor because he realized that I've got to put myself forward because nobody else is doing this. And I have a certain insight which no one else has. And so he got himself elected governor of New York, and then in 1932 he ran for president. Because he saw what was going on. Now the thing is that he was brilliant at he engineered a shift in politics in the United States, because up to that time, see, the Democratic Party had primarily been a party that was the party of Wall Street bankers. The Republican Party was the party of the working man. It was the party of Lincoln. But after the assassination of McKinley towards the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and into the 20th century, the Republican Party increasingly gotten taken over by Wall Street. So you had two parties in the country, which were both Wall Street parties, the Democratic and Republican Party. And Roosevelt came out of a Republican family, right? His cousin was Teddy Roosevelt, who was a Republican. So Franklin Roosevelt, though, worked with the Democratic Party and redefined the Democratic Party. For example, prior to Roosevelt, most African Americans voted Republican because Lincoln, the Republican Party, had been the party of Lincoln. Roosevelt forged a coalition within the Democratic Party of minorities, labor, what today is the current, what has been the Democratic Party coalition. And that's how he did it. So he was quite brilliant on that. In fact, actually, Roosevelt realized by the 1940s that he had used the presidency to develop very strongly the economic basis to defend the general welfare, which he thought would continue even beyond his death. But he was concerned that politically he hadn't secured this. So what he did was he was actually talking about, in 1944, he ran for president against Wendell Willkie. And he and Willkie were actually talking about forming a new party, a new political party out of the Willkie faction, the Democratic Republican Party, and the Roosevelt people from the Democratic Party, because Roosevelt was getting sick and tired of dealing with people like Truman and the Southern Democrats and so forth. So they were talking about forming a third party that would replace the Republican and Democratic parties as the party of, in the same way the Republican Party was organized out of the Whigs, when the Whigs became corrupt. But it never happened because Wilkie died and Roosevelt died.
Well, would not be that a good option for the Rouge movement to...
No, because since Roosevelt didn't do it, you have to do it within the Democratic Party, because that's the vehicle that exists. The Roosevelt legacy is in the Democratic Party.
Is it because if Roosevelt has done it, he has already been president, so people will...
I don't know if it would have succeeded. I'm telling you, this is what he was something he was intending to do. So it sort of doesn't really matter to think about it from a hypothetical standpoint, because it didn't happen. So the Roosevelt legacy is associated with the Democratic Party. But it also, there's a Roosevelt legacy in the Republican Party as well. So what you can get is that sort of Roosevelt legacy out of the Republican and Democratic parties to work together from the standpoint of somebody in the Democratic Party. The politics in the United States, this is very confusing for people who live in a parliamentary system. Because in a parliamentary system, the party is the primary thing. It's not the primary thing in the constitutional system. Every elected official in the United States is actually elected as an independent. No congressman or senator serves as a member of a party per se. They're trying to turn, it's becoming increasingly in practice to try and adopt these parliamentary types of actions. But the government doesn't fall, the Congress doesn't fall if the Republicans vote against the president or vote against their party. In a parliamentary system, if the party that forms the government, if enough members of that party vote against the government falls. Right? Or if you have a coalition government between two parties and one of the parties pulls out of the coalition government, the government falls. So the members of parliament have to vote according to their party interests, not according to their own individual interests. But in the U.S. system, every congressman, the congressmen are elected every 2 years as independent from each individual district, whether they're Republican or Democrat. So they can vote against the Republican. A Republican can vote with the Democrats, and Democrat can vote with the Republicans. And the government doesn't fall. The Congress doesn't dissolve. The Senate, only one-third of the Senate is elected every 2 years. The senators serve for 6 years. So two-thirds of the Senate is continuous. The Senate is like a continuous institution. Only one-third changes every 2 years. So the Senate doesn't change even as frequently as the presidency. So you see, you have this, an elected senator can look and say, well, I have to vote and make my policy based on what's in the interest of the country, not what's in the interest of the party. This is why you see Republicans now are breaking from Bush. In fact, when the system, when the American system was founded, George Washington and Hamilton and all these guys opposed parties. They hoped and they specifically said that parties should not exist in the United States. But by 1800, parties had formed. But the parties in the United States were never parliamentary parties, although right now they're starting to become that. This is what Tom DeLay tried to do with the Republican Party, and Cheney tried to do with the Republican Party, is to make that more like a parliamentary party, where the members of the party have to go along with the party discipline.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to be elected, you have to stuck with the party ID.
That's what they want to have happen, right? But even for, you know, when Roosevelt was president, there was a Democratic Congress, Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House, and he had to fight them. So, you know, to have a the party, that's the whole point about the party, the idea of the party, American institutions, that they're becoming weaker because they're becoming more like a parliamentary party. But it's not inherent in our system to be a parliamentary party. And that's what Roosevelt had with the Democratic Party. It was not a parliamentary party. And Roosevelt was able to build coalitions with people who would oppose him on one policy. Or you like to take another example in the 1960s. Johnson, who was a Southern Democrat, was for civil rights. But the Southern Democrats were opposed to civil rights. And the way Johnson got, but the Northern Democrats were for civil rights. And some of the right-wing Republicans were against civil rights, but a lot of the Northern Republicans were for civil rights. So what Johnson did was made a coalition of Democrats, who was Democrat, made a coalition of Democrats and Republicans that put together that was sufficient to pass a civil rights bill over the objections of the members of his own party. You can do that in the American system. You can't do that in a parliamentary system. Once you control the parties, you control it. And you look at Canada, I mean, parties come and go in Canada like flies.
Yeah.
I mean, the Conservative Party was in power, and then it was down to two seats in the parliament, right? And what was it, 1994 or something?
Mm-hmm.
93, 94. It went from the majority party to two seats. Disappeared altogether, right? Now it's in power again as a minority. The BQ goes from, you know, loses 10 seats to the Conservatives in this last election. So that's the way it works.
I think you addressed this a little bit earlier, but I think that in Canada, you know, we have this dynamic, it's a bit different in the States, I suppose, you know, I think most of us experienced this at some point. So I think this would be good for like the members and also people who are either coming out and wondering about all this, the political stuff that's going on, and these questions of what we can do and acting on truth as opposed to power. How do we deal with this problem of, because I mean, you know, we see like we all get demobilized at some point as organizers, where it's like we can lose focus maybe or lose sight of this mission or this intention that we're trying to bring about. I'm just wondering if you have anything to offer in terms of how, or even this problem of people who like our ideas, you know, contacts who like our ideas, think what we're doing is a good, you know, is good and necessary, but somehow have problems seeing themselves doing the same, mm-hmm. doing the same thing, or making that kind of breaking past maybe a comfort zone of a lifestyle or something like this. Because we experienced over the last, well, I've been with the movement now for a little bit over a year. You know, experienced members leaving or coming back. Like I dropped out for a few months last summer, and Julian dropped for a little while, but he's back now. And just on how we address that as individuals, but also amongst ourselves, either to support each other or help ourselves get past that. And for people who are here right now and hopefully thinking about this question, considering the time that we're in.
Well, here's the way I think you should think about that. First of all, fundamentally, the way to think about that is with this question of mortality. Because regardless of whether you're American, Canadian, Australian, whatever country you're from, we're all human. And this question of immortality is the one that ultimately is the one we all as individuals must face. When you die, nobody dies with you. You know, you face that question alone. It's what Schiller talked about in the Ode to the Sublime, right? The people are free to do whatever they want except not die. And so that's how do you, and Lynn of course has emphasized this so much, right? You have to live your life from the standpoint of of immortality. Because you don't know when you're going to die. You know, you're young, but you could die young. You could die old. You don't know that. Nobody knows that. So you have to live your life at every moment from the standpoint that whenever you have to face that question of death, that you face that question from the standpoint of knowing that no matter when you die, you live for as long as you can because of all the work you have to do. But you have to face that from the standpoint of immortality, and that's the real fundamental question. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a certain element. I'll say this: there's something which I think tends to be exaggerated. There is a certain frustration, I think. Organizers in Canada sometimes get, which I don't think is unique to Canada, but it's anybody trying to organize outside the United States, there's a certain frustration that there you can't actually get in and defeat Cheney from within Canada. And so you get somewhat frustrated. You say, well, you know, if Lynn is saying, you know, the whole future of civilization depends on defeating Cheney and Bush, what are we going to do to defeat Cheney and Bush, you know, in Canada? And you can't be expected to defeat Cheney and Bush from within Canada. And I know there's a certain amount of frustration comes up. I think also you get a certain thing, and this is what I think is over-exaggerated, is that in Canada sometimes, in other countries outside the United States, you tend to have an underling mentality. It's actually less in Canada than in Europe, which is that, well, you know, the big decisions, the big powers are made in the United States. We may like them, we may not like them, but it ultimately, you know, so people are passionate about what they like and don't like. But deep down inside, they say, it doesn't really matter because, you know, I can rail against Bush all I want. He's going to do what he wants. And if I can support Bush all I want, he's still going to do whatever he wants, right? He's not going to control him. I think that's a little bit over-exaggerated in the sense of it becomes somewhat of an excuse often when people say, well, we're Canadians, so since we're not going to make any difference, I can drop in and drop out. Because you get that also in the States. That's why I think it's fundamental question, this question of immortality. Because the funny thing is that LaRouche is a major political figure in Canada. And over the last 35 years, there's always been an active, growing, and effective LaRouche youth movement in Canada. And the funny thing is, when you talk to Canadians in the movement, they often say, well, it's really hard to organize in Canada, which is somewhat of a paradox, because they're recruited. You're Canadian. So how can you say it's hard to organize in Canada when Canadians are joining the LaRouche youth movement and organizing in Canada? So it's somewhat of a paradox. Anywhere you are, you can look at it and say it's hard to organize here. I mean, Matt can tell you about probably organizing in Boston, the kind of jerks you run into on the street there, the people you run into campuses who give you the same load of bullshit you guys are running into here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can overemphasize that problem. But I do think there's a certain frustration that might come up, right? That, you know, you want to get in there and, you know, change the U.S. government. But you can change the U.S. government. You can have an effect on it, but it's not a direct effect, but it's an important effect by making yourself the movement in Canada which is building the ability in Canada to collaborate with a changing United States. If we lose in the United States, there's not going to be any hope for Canada. If we win in the United States, there's going to be a great need for this effort in Canada. Mm-hmm. So the let's be optimistic. Let's plan to win. The expecting to win means that there has to be a collaborative effort between the youth of Canada and the youth of the United States on the collaboration for developing the planet. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to be doing. And I think that, but I think ultimately that rests on this question of immortality. Mm-hmm. You can't say, well, because Buchanan didn't succeed or the Quebecers, you know, turned Benjamin Franklin down on his offer, that Canada is hopelessly property of the Queen. It's not. You know, it's not. And, you know, as Lynn said, you just got to make yourself important. You are important. And that's the way I think, that's the thing I think. I think that the biggest problem that sometimes you face, and it's not just here, it's everywhere, is you get, there's a lot of social pressures. Oh, you guys aren't really getting anywhere. Why don't you just go along? We get that nagging everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's nagging from people who are accepting what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the way you are able to stand up to people who are accepting the world sinking into fascism is you decide, if the whole world's going to sink into a fascism, I'm not going down with it. I'm not going to accept it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lead the resistance. And in fact, I think we do, and I'm optimistic that we don't have to be the guys who resist ultimate destruction. Success is not guaranteed, as Lynn often says, but the possibility of success is guaranteed. And as long as the possibility of success is guaranteed, I think we can succeed. Mm-hmm. So expect to succeed, which is really, since it's necessary, it will happen. You can't say, is it going to happen? Well, first ask the question, is it necessary? If it's necessary, we have to make it happen. You can't say, well, will the necessary happen? The answer to that is you don't know. But if it's necessary, then you have to make it happen. But if it's necessary, how can you say you're not going to make it happen? And I think that, I guess the one other thing I would just add is that I think what we started this weekend, after what Lynn initiated several weeks ago with the idea of a more collaboration between Boston and Montreal, mm-hmm. and I think it's getting started on a really good level this weekend with Matt coming up here, that this will help a lot. Mm-hmm. See yourself as what this really is, which is, you know, it's two countries, but it's really one economy. It's mm-hmm. really one region. And so we've got, you know, this expanded collaboration between Boston and Montreal. That's not to have Montreal be absorbed into Boston, but it's to strengthen so that we can expand and build and strengthen our operation in Montreal. And since you're so close to Boston, which has, you know, a good reservoir of capability, that will help you strengthen what we have here, which you know, you'll be able to get the help you need. But you have to build it up yourselves. You know, Lynn's not building the youth movement. You know, the youth movement has to build itself. Mm-hmm. So in a certain sense, having to confront the kinds of problems which you're talking about, the only real solution for them is you guys figuring out yourself. It's not going to come from me or anybody else telling you how to do it. But now you've defined the problem. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate solution to that problem is how you guys figure out how to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. We have to make a discovery.
Yeah. But you do it if you work together, collaborate, don't get so frustrated if people argue about it. You know, you fight and you argue and you can't solve the problem. Don't get so frustrated. Don't give up. Don't say, we can't figure out how to solve the problem, we can't get along. So that means we can't have a youth movement in Montreal. I mean, that's part of solving the problem, is going through that process where people are trying to figure out how to solve it. And sometimes, that's also why we got to grow. I mean, Lynn says you really do need 15 people to make a movement. Mm-hmm. Because if you have 15 people and you got enough people, that somebody's going to have an insight that's going to help you solve a problem. Mm-hmm. And you have enough, but you'll still have a lot of dialogue. Right? If you have less than 15 people, then it is possible that out of 7 or 10 people, nobody will have a clue what to do. But if you have 15, you're likely that somebody is going to have a clue, even if 14 don't. And they may not actually know, but at least they might ask the right question, which then inspires somebody else to figure it out. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's also, we have to protect this. Yeah?
I have a question. I understand U.S. economy is essential in our planetary economy or world economy. But what you're saying is that if it doesn't happen in the U.S., it's never going to happen. Could it not happen in somewhere like, for instance, the European Union? If you have some sort of like,
No, not because of the economic power of the United States. Well, partly because of the economic power. But mainly because of the political tradition of the United States. Look at the Gettysburg Address. The Gettysburg Address of Abraham Lincoln. You should read it. It's very short. It's 240 words long. But this is an address. I don't know if you have a copy here. This was the address that Lincoln gave in the fall of 1863.
Lincoln?
Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln. Is that in the Lincoln Memorial? Yeah, it's on the Lincoln. One of the addresses on the Lincoln Memorial is the Gettysburg Address. The other is his second inaugural address. And this was in the Gettysburg, the Battle of Gettysburg was, July 1863. And in November 1863, I think it was November, in the fall, they dedicated the battlefield as a cemetery. Because there were thousands and thousands and thousands of soldiers who died in 3 days. And it was the bloodiest battle. It was the second bloodiest battle in world history. The first bloodiest battle occurred about 3 weeks earlier in Antietam.
In where?
Antietam, which is over the border in Maryland. This U.S. Civil War was the bloodiest war with the most casualties that had ever occurred in human history. And this was...
You mean in terms of number? Or
in terms of numbers of casualties.
Numbers?
Yeah.
Not like proportional to the population?
No, in terms of numbers of casualties. It was an incredibly bloody civil war, and this was all taking place, within a country. Mm-hmm. And these were family; these were, neighbors fighting each other, and it was really horrific. And Gettysburg was a horrific battle, but it was a key turning point because it was the highest northern advance that the Confederates had made. And had they not been defeated, there were two battles on July 4th. 1863. One was in Gettysburg and the other was in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And they were different battles. Vicksburg was a city and Vicksburg fell, which opened up the Mississippi River to complete Union control. In Gettysburg, the Confederates were defeated in Gettysburg on the same day. So in July, in the fall of that year, they dedicated the battlefield as a cemetery. And whenever anybody comes to Leesburg or to Virginia, Leesburg, it's only an hour and a half from our national office, but you should visit the battlefield at Gettysburg. But there was a dedication ceremony, and Lincoln, who was president, was not the main speaker. the main speaker was a guy named Everett, who was a senator, who was like the greatest orator of the Senate at the time. And he got up and spoke for 2 hours. And nobody to this day remembers his speech. It's totally forgotten. Wynne got up and spoke for 2.5 minutes. And people didn't even know he had spoken because he was finished before he sat down, right? But they read the words. And he describes in 240 words what the United States is about. And that is the reason why it has to come from the United States, because as he says in there, if that the issue of the U.S. Civil War is you have a nation that's based on an idea, and if this fails, and the question of the Civil War is whether or not such a nation, so conceived, can endure. Because since it had never occurred before in the history of mankind, and it had been brought into existence, the question was, could it endure? Or was this just an aberration? Were the oligarchs right, that man could not govern themselves this way? That was the issue. And he said, if we fail, if it cannot endure, this idea will perish from the earth. So it's important for mankind, not because it's the United States,
but it's the test.
Because it's a test of the nature of man. And that's why Roosevelt had this idea at the end of World War II that this was going to be the end of the empire system. And this system, this principle of government was going to be that any nation that wanted to adopt this was going to be protected to be able to develop this concept of government with respect to their own culture. This was the principle of Sun Yat-sen, for example, in China, which is a completely different culture, 5,000-year-old history, right? But culture. But Sun Yat-sen's idea of the three principles of the people was based on Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Government for the people, by the people, of the people. So it was, you know, Sun Yat-sen incorporated into his thinking as a Chinese patriot how to express these universal principles of man with respect to Chinese culture, and he fought to implement it in China. And this was the passion of Roosevelt and the fight Roosevelt had with Churchill. You know, he had this discussion, the famous, there's a very good book, if you can find it, by Elliot Roosevelt called As I Saw It. Elliot Roosevelt was Franklin's son. And he was assigned, when he was in the Army during World War II, to be an attaché to Roosevelt. So he witnessed a lot of these discussions between Roosevelt and Churchill.
His son,
Elliot. And he reports these in this book, which is very interesting because it's an eyewitness account. He was there in the meetings, right? And he describes, for example, a meeting when Roosevelt and Churchill are meeting in Casablanca in Morocco. And the Sultan of Morocco comes in and Churchill's sitting there, and Roosevelt strikes up a conversation with him, and the two men talk about all the things they're going to do to develop Africa during, you know, after the war. And Roosevelt's laying out all these plans. Because Roosevelt was famous, right? Because he had taken, you know, the Tennessee Valley in the United States before the TVA. The conditions of life in the Tennessee Valley were as bad as the conditions in most third world countries. They were African-style poverty in the Tennessee Valley of the United States in the 1930s. It was horrific poverty, horrific backwardness. And, you know, Roosevelt had demonstrated this transformation of these tremendously backward regions of the United States. So people were saying, you know, if this worked there, it could work here. So Roosevelt had these big discussions with his sultan. And after the guy left the room, Churchill was furious. He had to sit there and listen to this, right? And he said, what are you doing? He says, this guy, this is a colony. There's not going to be any development. And Roosevelt just said, listen, we're not fighting this war to defend the British Empire. Your empire's gone.
the Church says, I'm not Prime Minister to preside over the collapse of the British Empire.
Those are tough beans. You are. This empire is gone. The French Empire is gone. He fought with De Gaulle over that. And the Portuguese, he was against it. See, that was the tradition. So that's why. And that, see, that reservoir, that continued in U.S. policy. There was, after Roosevelt died, but there was sort of a split because you had the infiltration with Truman and the Dulles brothers and so forth of a British, pro-British policy in the U.S. foreign policy. So you had this sort of schizophrenic foreign policy where the United States would be part imperialist and part not. But it was, for example, Eisenhower, when Britain and France and Israel seized the Suez Canal. And here Eisenhower used the U.S. military to force Britain, France, and Israel to withdraw from the Suez Canal. And I heard a tape recently of an interview Eisenhower gave at the time. It was interesting, where Eisenhower said, hey, look, you know, I didn't like Nasser. Nasser was working with the Soviet Union. Nasser was a socialist, right? Eisenhower says, but heck, you know, the Suez Canal, this guy had every right to seize the Suez Canal. He says the Suez Canal was a private company. The Suez Canal of France and Britain, it was a private company. And it was in a country. And the president of the country had the right to seize the canal from a private company. And they don't have the right to go in, the governments of these countries don't have the right to go in and attack another country to protect a private company. So that was the Roosevelt impulse, Roosevelt-type impulse, right? So you had America by tradition is an anti-imperialist country. We've had imperialist policies imposed on us, and we've done some bad things. But America has done is actually better than most countries as far as its history and record goes of being anti-imperialist. It's got the best record, even though most recently it's had some pretty bad ones. And that's why it really has to come from the United States, because there isn't any country anywhere in the world that has that tradition. They have a tradition of collaborating with the United States in an anti-imperialist war.
But all the ideas of the Renaissance came from Europe.
So that's right.
But all that, they never came into practice there, is that?
Well, what happened was is that after the American Revolution, the intention was to then implement that in the Europe. And the French Revolution was the failure. Because you had Bailly, Jean-Sylvain Bailly, who was the mayor of Paris, who collaborated with Lafayette, who had been a collaborator with Washington and Hamilton and Franklin. And the two of them organized in 1789 to have a constitutional republic in France. And they, in order for the stability of the country, were going to allow the continuation of the monarchy in order to maintain the implemented republic. And the British used their agents, Jacques Necker, who's Swiss, Madame de Staël, others, Robespierre, the Jacobins and so forth, to undermine the initiative of Bailly and the Duc d'Orléans. And they used that to undermine Bailly and Lafayette, who were defeated by the Jacobins, and that then led to the Jacobin Revolution and the rise of Napoleon, which meant the reinstitution of, or it meant the prevention of the spread of the American Revolution to Europe. And that's the way history works. And Roosevelt was intending to turn that around. But you still have strong influences in European countries of this imperialist.
you know, you keep...
The other thing is that you keep... The problem is that because, you know, there are other factors, but, you know, the United States, really, when you look at the world today, there are really only three cultures that consider themselves world cultures, is influential in the world: the United States, Britain, and Russia. Different ideas of their world, but most other countries think of themselves not as world powers. China doesn't think of itself as a world power. India doesn't think of itself as a world power. Britain thinks of itself as a world power. Russia thinks of itself as a world power. So, part of it is whether or not, how many times you've been defeated in a war. Since all the European countries have been defeated so many times in the war, they don't really see themselves as being the world powers. The population has a defeatist status. That doesn't mean they're hopeless. It just means they can't lead. The leadership has to come. They will lead if they have leadership from the United States. If there's not leadership from the United States, other people won't lead.
You know, it's sort of,
sort of, I have another thought, but I'll save it.
But I just think, you know, in Canada here, that you guys just don't get so frustrated. Don't say, it's a hard fight. You gotta, you know, we know what you have to do. Overthrow the government and become the leadership of Canada. But, you know, it's a...
You know what I mean. You know.
That's what you have to do. And, you know, it's going to be a hard job. This is a long fight. It's a tough fight. And, you know, you got to fight it out. You work among yourselves and you'll solve these problems. But I think sometimes people, and this is not a Canadian problem, but oftentimes people, Matt can tell you all the problems, the things they've been in Boston. It's not like everybody in Boston is a perfect piece of cake and everybody knows what to do and you don't have any arguments. And, you know, but it's out of these kinds of discussions and problems and difficulties and how you deal with these things that you learn to help each other and solve these problems.
How do you deal with, I guess, the idea of populism? Like, how do you...
Ridicule it.
No, but I mean, how do you try to use... how do you try to get a point across in the population other than talking to people in the street? I mean, is there a way that we can use the media as well?
Yeah, you have to go out and talk to people face to face because you're exchanging ideas. You can use the media from time to time, but it you know, like Lynn does the webcast and so forth. But that's people, what we have to do is change the way people think, and that's done through dialogue. And there's no substitute for looking someone in the eye and having a discussion with them. Because even if that doesn't lead to a conclusion, that person doesn't forget that discussion. You might not see that person for 10 years, but they'll never forget the discussion they had with you if you talk to them about on that level of ideas. Right? And there's no shortcut for that. There's no substitute for it. You just really do have to talk to people face to face. And it radiates out, because that person who you talk to, you might not see again, you might not hear from again, but they're going to be talking to all kinds of people about the guy they met in the street who said this to them and had this discussion. And there's people who heard about it from someone else who come up to them. The point is that you're always radiating out, and that's producing a quantity of effect. The large numbers of people. But what you concentrate on is the quality of effect. In other words, don't worry about large numbers.
go for the quality. You're looking for the thinkers. If you focus on the quality of thinkers, you'll get the quantity. If you go for the quantity, you won't get either, because what will happen is you'll get people come around, and they won't really get a sense that what you really want to do is develop their mind. You really want to fill the chair in the room. And they're going to be confronted. New people come in, and they look at this stuff, and my God, you know, Archytas, Gauss, Leibniz, Bach, what the hell, where do I get started, right? So if you say, well, I don't have time to educate you to talk about this stuff with you because we got to go out and get more people to sit in these chairs, you know, it doesn't work. So the thing that works is exchanging ideas. And the ideas are dialogues, it's discussion. You know, that's why Socrates said, don't write things down, go talk with people, face to face. Yeah. So there's no substitute for that. Field organizing, discussions, that's what... This is most important, yeah.
But you still need to get a critical mass in order to change the mentality.
No, you change the, you know, it's not a numbers thing. It's the quality changes the mentality.
Yeah, but if you have like a 5% or 1% that changes...
No, it doesn't work that way. The way it happens is that you have a movement that represents that just by its existence and what it does and its practice is... in the right direction, that influences, that has an influence on society much larger. There's not a critical mass in which determines it. What determines it is not the quantity. What determines it is the quality of the ideas. If you have a movement, no matter how small it is, that has the right quality of ideas, the larger quantity of people will be influenced by those ideas over time and as the crisis develops. A number of people does not determine it. The quality of ideas determines your influence, your ultimate influence. And so we have to focus on the quality of ideas. And then, if you focus on the, ironically, if you focus on the quality of ideas, you'll get the quantity. Because people will say, oh, this is a group of people who are really serious about ideas. They don't bullshit around. Those are the people I trust. When a crisis, it's like Lincoln, you know, if I want the compromise, I go to the idiots. If I want reality, I go to LaRouche. So, you know, that's what most of the time people don't want reality. But when the crisis develops, they say, hey, I got reality. So what you're looking for is the people who are moral, who are not the people who wait for the last minute, say, well, I guess if Hitler's going to come, I don't want to be, maybe we should make a last ditch effort to stop him. You want the people who say, I'm going to do what's right because it's morally right. Well, Lin once said to me, he said, sometimes people talk about that they try and express our influence by describing the number of people who are listening to us, the number of people who are influenced. And he said, that's bullshit. He said, I'd be right if nobody was listening. Lin doesn't measure his whether he's right or not by the number of people who are listening to him. He says what has to be said and says, if you listen to me, there's a way out of this. If you don't listen to me, and here's what's going to happen. And if people don't listen to him, he doesn't say, ha ha, I told you so. He says, well, I told you, you should have listened to me. Now here's what you should do.
Don't listen to me.
You don't listen to me again. You know, I can't make people listen to me. He says, Lin can't make people listen to him. But if they don't, that's what's going to happen. But you don't give up on people. We're the Good Samaritan. We're the people people are in the ditch. You don't complain about if you're a physician, you don't complain that your patients are sick. So we're the physicians of society. It's sick. The patients are sick. We got a lot of sick people to deal with. So you don't worry about the fact that, the people are sick. You go heal them.
You don't complain about it.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a doctor sitting there saying, God damn, all I did was look at sick people all day. Why don't I get some healthy people to come in here? These sick people are really pathetic. They come in here coughing and sneezing and looking all miserable.
Wasting my time.
You know, what are all these sick people doing coming in my office? So we're the physicians of society.